Hey, you guys, the Other People podcast is offered freely. All episodes of this show are available for free. You can listen to all of it for free. Your support makes a difference. If you would like to support this program, you can do so at patreon.com/otherpplpod. That's patreon.com/otherpplpod. Thank you.
You are not alone. You have found other people.
You and I have a friend in common.
Every stupid thing that a writer could do, I've done.
I think it's really beautiful.
Big, stated quest, struggle, you know?
It was incredible. You know, it's like your head exploded seeing what was really there.
And now here's your host, Brad Listy.
Just one person at just one time.
Hey. This is the Other People podcast. I'm Brad Listy. It's nice to be with you. I am in Los Angeles. I'm like watching the Brewers versus the Dodgers as I'm doing this. I'm a huge Milwaukee Brewers fan. I grew up, well, you know, cheering for the Brewers. I say I'm a huge fan. The truth is that I haven't had much to cheer for the past, 35 years. But when I was a kid, they were really good. That's kind of the last time they were this good. And now they're good. They could go to the World Series. And I'm watching baseball, and I'm just riveted. And I just want to give a shout out to postseason baseball. I know this isn't a sports podcast. I know most of you probably aren't sporty. You're book nerds. You don't give a shit. But try watching a playoff baseball game. Every pitch matters. There's like this real tension and excitement. It's excellent. So anyhow, I hope you're doing well. I have Christy Coulter on the program. She has an essay collection out that's available from MCD/FSG Originals. It's called Nothing Good Can Come From This. And it's about sobriety. It's about drinking and quitting drinking. And she and I had a great conversation. We got into all sorts of things, and I'm going to get you right to that. Does that sound good? Here's my conversation with Christy Coulter. Her essay collection, one more time, is called Nothing Good Can Come From This.
I didn't want to write a chronological, like I was born in 1970 kind of memoir. It just wasn't interesting to me. Like, and I had read, so Claire Dieterer is a friend of mine, and her book Poser was really interesting to me in that she takes a different yoga pose as each chapter's theme.
Oh, right.
Yeah. And so she kind of moves forward in time, but she also looks at her life through the prism of yoga in a bunch of different ways. And so I thought, well, that seems like more fun. So I was really concerned with what would be fun for me to write. And then I figured I'd worry about whether it's going to be fun for people to read later on.
That's a novel idea.
Yeah, exactly.
You're actually worried about fun.
It's like, I'm going to spend 2 years writing this. I want to kind of enjoy it.
You're not just going to torture yourself.
No. And
like the rest of us.
You get plenty of that, right? I mean, there was plenty to come. I thought at least try to front load or try to bias toward fun. So I just wanted to look at drinking, but especially sobriety, or more broadly, like what happens when you take away the one thing you think you can't live without. I wanted to look at that from a bunch of different angles, and doing it as essays seemed to be the best way to do that.
So let's talk about your drinking,
mm-hmm.
and then your decision to quit drinking.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, writing it's well documented that this profession is fraught with mm-hmm. peril when it comes to substance abuse. That's kind of, I mean, it's a cliche, the hard drinking writer or whatever, but I think the issue obviously transcends, it goes beyond. For you personally, like started as a teenager?
Yeah, I think I was 16. I was actually very afraid of drinking before that, not of people drinking in general, but just my own drinking. I remember when I heard that Boy George had like a drinking and drug problem, I was devastated. I don't know why.
As were we all.
We were all just shocked. I was shocked, more to the point, which just seems kind of funny now. But yeah, I think I was at a party and somebody gave me a wine cooler and I was nervous.
Bartles
so I drank
and James?
It. Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
There's also Seagram's, I guess that's the other one. And I was like, not nervous anymore. And I thought, well, this is great. So I found a solution. So, you know, I drank in high school, weekends, parties, that kind of thing. And then in college. And then I just never really stopped. I think what happened is I drank the way a lot of people drink in college. And then other people stop drinking the way they drank in college once they're not there anymore. And I just didn't.
You just kept rolling.
Yeah. I was like, it's still undergrad. It was still undergraduate years. This is great.
Well, I think back to my own. I mean, I've actually talked on this show about drinking mm-hmm. and my drinking and like thought through it aloud.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sensitive about it. and just wanting to make sure.
Yeah.
Like, is this like, I only have like a glass or two of wine a day, but like, why am I doing that every day?
Right.
I had that sort of thought. And then I stopped. Mm-hmm. I was kind of checking myself, but it's not, you know, it's not something that I can engage in without having feelings of guilt or concern or self, you know, it's just my nature.
Like just wondering why you're
just
doing
wondering
it.
Why, yeah, yeah. Wondering why, like why do I need this? Or do I need this?
Right.
Or why do I think I need this?
I've known people who quit because they were having one or two a day, which I'm like, hey, go for it. That's nothing. I mean, the way I used to drink. But they were like, I needed it too much and it really scared me. And I thought, if I need it this much now, what's it going to be like in 15 years? And so they quit and they actually identify as alcoholics, even though they were drinking what, you know, even medically. Well, now there's new studies saying that really no drinking is great for you.
It fluctuates.
Right. That
sort of shit bugs me.
Yep.
Like I was just having a conversation with like an uncle. He was in town and he was talking about diet and he was asking, cause I'm a vegetarian. Mm-hmm. He's like, you still a vegetarian? Yes. And he's like, have you read so-and-so? And it was like some author who like basically was saying that like, if you eat plants, they're terrible for you. And I was just like, you know what? You can Google anything.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Get either a justification for or against that seems very convincing.
Oh yeah. Actually the other day, a Facebook friend posted a link to a study, like a real study, double blind, long-term, that showed that diet just might not matter that much at all. If you're at a certain baseline,
yeah.
And you basically are, you know, eating decent food, like whether you eat carbs or meat or plants, it's, you know, it's more about your genetics.
It is.
It's a relief to see it. I'm sure they'll change their minds again. But
I mean, that's consumption too. Mm-hmm. Like all of these things are tied together, whether it's food or drink or drugs or money, mm-hmm, or sex or media, mm-hmm, or social media.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah,
these things are all of a piece to me. And I think you could make the case that any of them, you know, people use them to anesthetize pain.
Yeah. Or to, you know, there's like this sort of void that we're all afraid of. I'm afraid of it anyway. And we think we can fill it. And I don't think you can actually fill it.
What do you mean by the void?
Well, it's just like there's so much unknown. There's so much unknown in the world. The future is kind of scary. Certainly these days, the future's scary.
Death? I mean, is it death?
Death? Yeah, I think ultimately it's death. Like, I don't particularly want to die, do you?
No, the process of dying doesn't sound enjoyable. I think being dead, I'm less worried about.
I think I'm getting there.
I think, like, being dead, I don't think I'm going to have any... I think I'm just going to go wherever I was when I was born. That's my suspicion.
Right.
It's like, wherever... Like, if there was some existence or, like, chain of existence that I was a part of before I manifested in this form, I'll go back there. And I have no recollection of it.
Mm-hmm. It was apparently fine.
Right, right. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
But what do I know? I have no idea. I feel like, you know, the pain and suffering that go along with being ill, mm-hmm, the emotional pain of saying goodbye to loved ones and the world. I mean, you know, that's going to be
sad.
That's going to be sad.
It's really sad, even though the world can be a really difficult place. I still... rather, you know, I like it. I like being here.
Yeah.
I think it's fear of death. It's fear of, the dying process, of the unknown. I mean, I'm an anxious person just by temperament. Uh-huh. So I think that I kind of wanted to drink to sort of engineer my own experience. Like I kind of wanted my whole life to be like a montage, uh-huh, in a movie. And I would use drinking to kind of dial it up and dial it down and try to make all my experiences perfect.
Like an action movie?
No,
a
like a romantic comedy, probably.
Okay.
You know, where people are just, they're in nice places eating glamorous food, laughing with their heads thrown back.
Like Nancy Meyers.
Yeah,
like everyone's wearing pashminas and
right, chunky knits.
And just like lives in a beautiful house in Cape Cod or something.
Right, right. Giant 8-burner wolf range.
You know? Right, exactly.
Yes, that's what I wanted.
That is the dream. Don't we all want that?
Yeah.
But, you know, I think back to adolescence and the role that alcohol plays for most kids, at least American kids and, you know, high school and college. You know, it's a social lubricant.
Mm-hmm.
And it is, you know, if you're, I think everyone's a little anxious at that age.
Yeah. If you're not, then
but it's also like, you know, you're so hormonal,
mm-hmm,
and like, I remember just being social and like not having any clue how to talk to girls.
Right.
And being in parties and like all of a sudden you know, all of your inhibitions go down and like all your fears go away.
Yeah. It enables you to act and sort of to kind of, it's ironically to act naturally.
But you act like a fucking asshole.
Well, right.
Too.
But you don't know that at the time. It's the blessing of it is that you don't know.
I know. But I look back and I'm like, God, like it's just a dipshit.
Yeah.
And just embarrassing.
Yeah.
You know, I guess most people go through that, but I was just telling a guest recently, like I still look back and just like, I feel like real pain thinking back to how stupid that was.
But the people that you were with were your age, probably were also drinking in
sure.
that moment.
So a lot of them were more fucked up than I was.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's kind of like there's this group absolution, I think. You have to just absolve each other. Like, yeah, we were 16. We're total fucking idiots. And we were doing, our brains weren't
20.
Even formed. Or 20 or 35, whatever. I get specific.
Yeah, right.
It's interesting now because I'll be around people who are drinking. And like the first drink, two drinks, you know, they're totally fine. The third drink is like the tipping point for most people, unless they have extraordinary tolerance, where they talk louder. They start to repeat themselves at like the third drink. I had no idea. Because I always thought I could have six drinks and be just fantastic, great company. They get emotional sometimes, like some crying will start. It just doesn't take as much as people think. And I can be in a position now to observe this. I don't observe it for very long because it really bores me.
It's also annoying.
It's depressing and annoying. Yeah.
It is. Like to be the sober person, like not even if you don't even have to be like officially sober.
Right.
But
right.
just to be the person who's not drinking or is not fucked up and to be surrounded by people who are drunk. Drunk people. Are annoying.
It's they're really annoying. You and you don't have to be like quote unquote sober. You're just not drinking that night, and it's like you're all in one place together, and then they go someplace else, and you still have to listen to them yell,
right?
You know, you can't just be alone and read your book. You know, I gave myself permission really early on to just leave. Because it was touch and go. I was like, well, I don't want to drink, so you can just leave a party whenever, and I kind of still do that.
Just ghost it.
Yeah.
Like you don't even say like someone I was yesterday, I was at an office function and somebody's like, I'm going to do the Irish goodbye.
Yeah.
Is that what it's called?
I only heard that from Daphne, my editor, recently, the Irish goodbye. You just leave. Yeah.
I got to get into that. I always feel like my wife is the worst. She stays at a party. She's the last one. And I'm always like looking at my watch. I'm like, she says goodbye to everyone.
Right,
she lingers. She just enjoys, like, she really enjoys it.
It's not just politeness. It's like actually.
She likes to hang.
Yeah.
You know?
I hate to hang. I hate
and
it.
And I'm just like, let's get the fuck out of here.
Yeah. Yeah. There's actually a line in my book about like, I like to leave. Like if I'm at a group dinner, it's fine. But if the dessert menus come and people start talking about dessert and coffee and like, after dinner drinks, I'm like, fuck you all. I got to get out of here.
Yeah.
Like, and I like dessert too a lot, but it's like, that's enough. It's been an hour and a half. We need to go. There's 10 of us, too many people. I'm very rigid.
And then everybody's like, should we split the check?
Oh God.
And it's just like, oh God. And everyone's got their credit cards out. Yeah. And it's like, shoot me.
Yeah. I was at a dinner for 16 people the other night. It was really fun actually. But then it got to the point where, and it was all women. Which somehow makes the goodbye thing different because it's super intense.
Okay.
Everyone's like, I love you. I love you too. And we were all sober too.
Let's not get carried away.
Right. And the check splitting was just, I mean, if it hadn't been 16 people, I would have just been like, I will pay for it.
I do that. And like, it's not necessarily generosity as much as it's just like anxious. Like, okay, I don't want to do this to the server.
Right.
I know. I often will do that. I mean, if it's 16 people, I'll
one's
be patient and I'll sit there and split it up. But like, if it's like, I don't know, six.
Yeah, I'll just pay it.
I'll
and there's
like,
Venmo if people want to pay you back.
Yeah.
You're not even necessarily going to eat it.
Or but, like, you get the next one. But like, let's not sit here for a half an hour doing math.
Yeah, I'll chew my own arm off. It's pretty bad. So I've had to, like, one thing I've noticed about getting sober is these things, like, that was always in me and I would just suppress it. So now it's just like, nope, I'm the asshole who's going to leave, you know?
Right.
And I'll be nice about it. And I will try to say goodbye to the host, but I won't try that hard.
Yeah.
You know,
you know what? Nobody, like, the thing about it too is like, you think everyone's going to be like, where'd she go?
Right.
No one's thinking about
right.
you.
Right. Right.
They're like too drunk or they're focused on themselves or dealing with something else.
Yeah. They're
you
not
just,
keeping
you just
a
leave.
Head count.
And okay. So you, I mean, I don't want to get too far out of chronology just because I do think, it's worthwhile to get like a sense of like your story.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, but you went through your 20s, you sort of kept drinking at the same pace.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of dialed it back. Like, I made a good attempt to be like a grown up, and I was never a big like what I call a woo girl. I was never like one of the girls drinking and being like woo.
That's actually how I am. I'm very a woo boy.
I used to live across the street from a hockey team, and at the University of Michigan, and they were. That was like a very weird male form of drinking where they would fight each other.
Like a whole team?
Yeah. Well, it was like, it couldn't have been the whole team, but it was like seven or eight guys in one of those huge converted houses that are just housing students. And my husband and I would wake up at like 4 a.m. and they'd be out in the street just brawling.
Oh my God.
And they were so drunk. And I was like, this is very weird. It was like a fight club.
Feel uncomfortable.
Oh, it was terrible. It was really terrible. I doubt they're probably all dead now.
I'm like, feel like that when you told me that, I just like all of a sudden, like a lot of my like hope for humanity just started to drain out of my body, like through my feet into the floor. Just like thinking of like,
yeah,
bros.
Oh, yeah.
In the yard.
They were pretty bad. I was like, you're friends. You live together. Why are you fighting? Why are you fighting with your fists now? I sound like their mom.
Well, they're hockey players. It's like masculine ritual.
Yeah.
And proving ground kind of thing.
Super drunk.
And then you wake up in the morning and you're friends and you have no teeth.
Right. Exactly.
Great.
So that was not me. So I was like a wine drinker. I was very sophisticated and blah, blah, blah.
And also professionally, like you had some success. It wasn't like you were like destitute or like drinking yourself into the gutter. Like you were functioning as an adult.
Yeah. Over functioning.
In a lot of the ways. And you had a lot of the signifiers of I have my shit together.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, because I'd always been like that since childhood. I was like the girl who did the extra credit. I was like, I was a Hillary Clinton, basically.
Were you first child or what's your birth?
First. Okay. Yeah, of two. So, you know, I started reading young. I remember I have a very early memory of getting, in first grade, we would just get S's or N's on our worksheets for satisfactory or not satisfactory. And I once got an N and, because I had colored in all the pictures instead of just the ones with a certain sound. And, I was just weeping and I was still crying when my mother got to school to pick me up.
Damn.
And my teacher was just horrified. Like she had no idea that this was going to do this to me.
You were wound that tight.
Yeah. And I still remember it. I'm still kind of like, God, can I go just do that again? I'll do it better this time.
I'll make it right this time.
I'll make it right. I promise. So I was always over functioning and, I worked in tech, at Amazon for 12 years. So if you're over functioning there, you're barely functioning. I mean, it's such a high bar for performance that it's kind of like, people say it's where overachievers go to feel bad about themselves. So I was on.
Work environments are weird because like to actually have a healthy human environment, I shouldn't put it all in work because it's like, I think it's just human groups that are hierarchical. And that could even be a family.
Oh yeah.
You know, but the human communication, actually having like legit emotional health and well-being and an open flow of communication that's healthy is hard to do.
Yeah.
And I find
takes time.
And you know, you're in a work environment where, you know, the mission is to be great.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not a bad mission. Like let's build a great company or let's do something great in the work world. But then you bring in all these people who are achievers.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's all this like social pressure to like be like a badass worker.
Yeah.
And to be tough.
To be tough.
To be competent and not complain.
Mm-hmm.
To never admit to weakness.
Mm-hmm.
I'm tired. I need a day off.
Right.
And then you get into competitive stressing. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, there's so much competitive stress. Yeah. And we have one of the values at Amazon, and they have these leadership principles that they actually do live by. It's not just words on a wall, but one is to be vocally self-critical. And so, which I actually think is great because in a lot of companies, you never admit a mistake. And if you don't admit a mistake, you never really get better. But it meant that people were constantly, they took it too far, like castigating themselves for these simple human.
That's what this podcast is about.
Right, exactly. Let me tell you the five ways I fucked up this morning. And so I would have, and I managed a lot of people while I was there. And my best employees, like the people who were just brilliant and talented and hardworking, were the toughest on themselves. And there was nothing I could really say to get them, to convince them they were doing a great job and were not about to be fired. And I was the same way. I mean, I would try it with them because out of human caring. And because I worried about them, like, you're going to die by the time you're 40.
Right.
You just couldn't. You could order them to work fewer hours, take them off a project, and they would work on it, like, secretly.
Is that American? Is that how it is in the world?
I think there's something specially American about it. I think it's also peculiar to certain corporate cultures. I worked around the world. I was based in America, but I worked with international teams at Amazon, and it definitely, it was different in France.
People like take some time there.
Yeah, they were a little more chill, but there's so much, we would import talent from America into these, it's a chance to go work in France for 2 years. And so there'd be enough Americans in every office to kind of infuse
that. To toxify
it. Yeah, exactly.
Make everybody else sad and crazy.
Exactly, exactly.
Well, it's like, and the thing too, I think in France or in certain countries, you have time off that's sort of enforced
by
the government mandate. Mm-hmm. And I think when you have to self-enforce, mm-hmm. like there's all these companies where it's like, yeah, it's an open policy on vacation time. You know, you're an adult.
Right.
We want you to take time. But then it's like, and by the way, here's 10 projects.
Yeah.
And nobody else is taking time.
Yeah.
And so then you just wind up never taking time.
Why would I do this?
Yeah. I don't want to be the one who's like, oh, I'm going to take 3 weeks this summer to chill out.
Right. I would get so stressed before vacation. Just incredibly stressed. And then I would start dreading going back about 5 days before the end of my vacation. And, in some ways, I did that to myself. I could have said, hey, here are my limits. No one ever said, no, you can't have limits. But it was not the way. It just wasn't the way. Yeah. So you just end up feeling weird.
And alcohol factors in. I mean, work stress and also the social aspects of work.
Yep.
And when you have a group of people, which is the case in most companies, there aren't very many companies that are worth a shit that don't have people in there who are high achieving, mm-hmm. conscientious, want to do well, competitive, all mm-hmm. those things are going to be present pretty much anywhere you work.
Yeah, anywhere I'd want to work, honestly.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want to work in a company where it's just kind of where we were all just taking care of ourselves all the time because that would be really boring.
Yeah, you want to be challenged a little
bit. Yeah, yeah.
But then you have the stress that goes along with mm-hmm. that. And then you have the natural social functions, dinners and lunches and mm-hmm. company retreats. And people are using alcohol both to help them be social, mm-hmm. to numb themselves, and to kind of tone down that anxiety.
Yeah.
And all the stress, it's it's a very, very normal, common thing.
Oh, totally. It's a fast route to bonding with others too. If you're on, I taught at corporate retreats for a couple of years, and we'd bring in people from all over the world. A lot of them had never met each other before. And, you have a glass or two of wine and you're all these were super hard charging people. They're executives and they would have a glass or two of wine and they would be able to talk to each other and another two and they'd be hugging. And, and I remember I was sober at that point. I remember just being kind of jealous, oh yeah, I remember when it was that easy. And I was feeling very shy about, it's much easier for me to talk to people now that I'm sober. I can pretty much walk up to anyone and talk to them. But in that situation, I was definitely feeling the lack of being able to be part of the group and drinking and just showing, it's like you're showing your underbelly deliberately.
Right.
Which you would never do on the job unless you're,
And having the alcohol in your hand or participating in that ritual. If you showed your underbelly absent that, everyone would be like, whoa.
Right. Why is she doing that?
Yeah, right.
My dog lies like that sometimes. Why is she doing it?
You didn't even have a bottle of rosé. What's going on?
Yeah, you can't just be like, I'm feeling vulnerable right now. Yeah. Can I share with all of you?
Right.
And it's 80% men at leadership levels there too. So it would have been even weirder. But it was a way, I think, for the men to kind of soften up a little bit, get a little drunk. Cause then they could be like, well, I've had some wine. So let me tell you that I have a heart and I have emotions.
Well, yeah, there's all this pressure to be tough.
Yeah.
It's like the hockey team.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just without the overt, it's so depressing.
It was weird too. Cause it's really some genuinely, some of the best people I've ever met, people I hope I know the rest of my life and nice people. And you put all these nice people together who left to their own devices would be hard charging, but not insane, but you put them all together and they feed on each other, each other's energy. So they would become, you'd get them alone and you're like, well, you're just absolutely lovely. And you have all these interests and hobbies and, but in the office, there's no time for that. And we were moving so fast. I don't think I was bored a single day in 12 years.
I bet.
Yeah.
How could you be?
Right. And there were times when it was like, okay, a little boredom would be fine.
Yeah. Downtime's good.
You need a little downtime. And I started to learn that. And I would look for roles because you can kind of change, reinvent your career there. At will. I would look for roles sometimes where I would have a little more because I was like, I'm going to be better. And I was better at my job when I had some slack.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. Like, the, you know, there's all these studies done that if you give people more time off, like they're actually more productive.
Mm-hmm.
And if people are, you know, working 51 weeks a year.
Right.
And then like having like a weird Christmas and then coming back, like, you know, they're going to be there every day, but you're not going to get their best.
No. And plus at some point you're just living your life from the office too. You know, you're trying to do your Christmas shopping and
at Amazon.
Yeah, at Amazon.
So, okay. So you're working, you're succeeding,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You're drinking.
Yeah.
And, can you talk about how long were you battling with yourself about mm-hmm. whether or not this was a problem? Usually people go through a pretty long process.
Yeah.
It takes a while to kind of come to grips
with what's going. Yeah. I think it was probably a decade. I do remember Caroline Knapp's book, Drinking a Love Story, came out when I was like 26 or 27. And I read it and I thought, oh, I really, really identified with it. And then I kind of just shoved it away.
What did you identify with?
She would talk about things like watching the level of wine in the bottle, like if she was at dinner with a couple of other people to see if there would be enough. About being impatient when people drink too slowly because you don't want to be the one who's always refilling your glass. Things like little things that I had never seen anyone talk about before that were very much like a kind of professional woman drinking sort of anxiety that's not about being in the gutter.
I look at the level of the bottle. But
yeah.
Like, I mean, if you're at a dinner and you're trying to like make sure everybody has enough.
Yeah, but it's not – but you're worried about other people, not just you.
Yeah, I'm all about other people.
Yeah.
You're so selfish.
I was always like, will there be enough? Or are we going to order another bottle? Or should I get a glass? Or it's just always strategizing. Like, it's really exhausting.
And stressful.
Yeah, it's really stressful. So I think probably for a decade, I was like, do I have a problem? Do I not? And then I tried to moderate, which was hilarious. And I tried that for years. And it's funny when I quit, so many people don't like it when you quit drinking. And they'll be like, well, why don't you just moderate? And it's like, well, do you think maybe I tried that for a long time?
And I want to get to people adjusting to your sobriety.
Yeah.
But first I want to get to like
what
hitting bottom and like finally making the decision.
Yeah.
And I like that. I mean, I'll have you tell it, but I like your story in particular because it reminded me that they don't all look the same.
Yeah.
And it's not always like waking up behind a dumpster and being like, I got to change.
right.
Like these things, there can be small moments of epiphany or small moments of big human change, you know?
Right.
So talk about how you eventually arrived there.
Yeah. So I've been trying to moderate for years. It sucked. I always failed. And I got to the point where I was always worried about my drinking. Low level. 24/7. It was always somewhere in my brain. How much am I going to drink tonight? Am I going to be okay?
And it was usually night drinking.
Yeah, pretty much only night drinking. Like I didn't even like to drink during brunch. Like day drinking always felt just strange to me.
And then you just feel tired.
Yeah.
I don't understand day drinking at all.
I didn't do it. Yeah, I would just feel tired. And so it actually, in some ways, I was able to lie to myself longer because like I didn't drink on planes. I didn't drink in airports. I didn't drink during the day. So I was like, well, I'm not doing those things. Obviously, I'm only drinking a bottle of wine minimum a night. I'm fine. But I was so worried about it. I knew something was wrong. I knew I couldn't moderate. And so eventually, I just got so tired of worrying. And I didn't even have a big moment where anything happened. I suddenly one day was like, you know, the one guaranteed way to stop worrying about drinking would be to stop drinking. Because if you're not doing it, you can't worry about it anymore. And I think probably a few months after that, I woke up one morning, it was a Saturday, it was a beautiful day, woke up with a headache. And I just thought, I'm not going to drink tonight. And it was like I can even feel it now, like in my body, like how terrifying that was, the idea of going one night. But my husband was out of town, and I liked the idea that if I totally fell apart, I could do it by myself. It's like an animal thing. You know, I'm going to go into the pain cave or a marathoner thing. Right?
That's what this garage is.
Yes.
My pain cave.
The pain cave. And so I didn't tell anyone. I saw my best friend for lunch. I didn't mention it to her, and I just didn't do it. and I didn't die. I did fall asleep. I had these fears that I would never sleep again. Which is
taking the edge off at night.
Yeah.
All that work stress, all the whatever anxiety you got.
Yeah. It's a way of being like the day's over and you can rest.
Yeah.
And
how much were you drinking? Like you mm-hmm. weren't day drinking. You weren't plain drinking.
Right.
You weren't like mixing vodka into your coffee or anything mm-mm. like that at work.
No.
It wasn't like that, but you would come home and pretty much every night go through a bottle of wine.
Yeah. I probably would, by 8 o'clock have a glass of wine. And usually would end up having a whole bottle, sometimes more.
And like, and you say you can't moderate, meaning like you can't stop at 2.
No.
You always got to have another.
Yeah. I would do things like, I mean, just like I would pour a little more into the glass and be like, well, it's still the same. It's still the second glass.
Uh-huh.
I just poured a bunch of ounces into it.
Well, this is the thing. Cause like, you know, wine culture is big in California.
Mm-hmm,
and I think
mm-hmm.
it's also become like, this has changed in America.
Yeah.
When we were kids, like it was parents drinking like beer and gin and tonic.
Right.
And like maybe like a vodka tonic or something. But then at some point, like foodie culture, it's not all bad, but some of it's so fucking annoying.
It is. And I always found it annoying, even as a, because it's big in Washington too, wine culture.
It's like wine o'clock and all the stuff you write about with regard to rosé.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, these little like weird subcultures and like social habits that form around it, like, you know, bugs the shit out of me.
It's really irritating.
And it's a way to signify like bouginess.
Right.
Like I'm a wine drinker.
Right.
Oh, I love wine. And like everyone's like smelling their wine. And it's like, you know what? Yeah. There are like 100 master sommeliers in the world and you're not one
exactly.
of them.
Exactly. You're not even close, babe.
Who gives a shit? You know,
right.
like as long as it's not like spoiled.
Right.
You don't know the
Does
difference.
Does it taste good to you?
Right.
Great. You know, yeah, I mean, it's, and the thing is, you know, wine, like it is an art, like making people devote their lives to it. And, but I do think a lot of people are sort of using that fact to be like, I just like wine. I'm not a drinker.
Right. It's
like,
an artisanal.
We're still drinking.
Well,
alcohol.
I mean, I get it. Like I do like this idea of there is a romance to these artisans mm-hmm. who like grow the grapes in the soil and like mm-hmm. they're dependent on the weather and like, you know, like the,
yeah, it's kind of a miracle.
It's kind of a miracle. And like each season is different. Each bottle mm-hmm. captures something that, you know, like I can get into that. And having a really good glass of wine, there's nothing wrong with that.
Right.
And like enjoying wine and like wanting to read mm-hmm. about like, you know, it's just, I think kind of like the wider application of it or something and the way it's kind of taken over can be annoying, but it's also fascinating because I think it goes back to this issue of consumption and wanting to anesthetize ourselves
mm-hmm.
and then also wanting to feel a certain way about ourselves and our level of achievement. And you know what I'm saying?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I think it's, and for women especially, like I did some research when I first started writing one of the chapters in this book, and I was looking at the flappers, and the flappers actually were drinking and smoking as a feminist statement. And it was, and also because it was fun, but it was the idea that like, we're also allowed to have this kind of fun. We don't have to be blue stockings and be useful and be, you know, temperance people all the time. And so I think it's similar today. I think that a certain kind of woman, is over drinking in that same way. Well, like I can destroy myself just like a man. I can have fun.
It's a
and it's
bad
like,
competition to
and
get
it's like,
into.
You absolutely can. Like, I support your right to do it. It doesn't mean it's a great idea. But it is a marker of like, I'm powerful. I'm strong. I can, you know, women, I can drink any man under the table. Well, great. Good for you.
Yeah.
You don't have the same enzymes that man does, first of all. So you're going to, and this is another thing is I was convinced, you know, there's science showing that women, it's not just because of our size, but because of our insides, our enzymes that we can't process like alcohol, like men can. And I was like, oh, that's just a scare tactic. You know, they're just trying to scare women out of having fun. And no, it's actually true. You know, it's actually science, but I convinced myself that had to be wrong. Yeah, I was absolutely one of those people who wanted to be, you know, I'm just living, doing the finer things. And there is art to it, even with liquor now, with gin. And you know, I'm working on a novel and there's a character who's a gin maker. And like, that's incredibly complicated. And you can do these beautiful things with it. But we do fetishize that craft in a way that I think is partly about hiding the fact that we just want to get some ethanol into our bloodstreams.
Right. Yeah. It's like if you present yourself as being like a, you know, having this rich appreciation for the terroir or whatever.
Right,
it's like
right.
suddenly like nobody will notice that you're pouring yourself like that fifth glass.
Right. Cause you're not tasting it after that. Yeah. I mean, maybe a glass, maybe two. And you don't, I mean, turnips have terroir to also, right? But you don't see people like having clubs for turnips.
Yeah.
They're pretty good.
Well, yeah. And it's like the other thing too is like, what's a glass? Mm-hmm. I mean, you alluded to this earlier, but it's like, you know, I think it's like, what, 2 ounces or something?
I think it's 5 ounces.
Or, okay, yeah.
It's not very much.
It's not very much when you look at a glass.
Yeah.
So when they say like 2 glasses of wine a day for a man, 1 for a woman, mm-hmm. in terms of like the healthy amount.
10 ounces.
But most people who are doing a home pour, myself mm-hmm. included, mm-hmm. it's probably, because I, you know what I always do is I just look at the bottle.
Yeah.
And I think like 2 glasses is like about half a bottle.
Right.
And I always stop there. Mm-hmm. But then I'm like, did I just drink 2 glasses or did I actually drink 3?
Right.
I don't know. You know, like the liquid, I'm not going to sit there and measure liquid ounces.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It gets a little ridiculous. But
nobody really knows. But yeah, 5 ounces is shockingly little. I mean, it's especially if you have like the kind of larger wine glasses. Most people don't have different glasses for all the different types of wine. The all purpose ones, it looks like it's a third full, maybe.
Yeah.
Like it looks sad.
Well, I'm at the point now where I'm like, I'm sort of down on alcohol. Mm-hmm. Just because of the way it's been marketed and sold to us. And it's really just not that great for you. And like you sort of behave like an asshole if you have too much of it.
Yeah.
So I'm like into, now that pot is legal in California, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. like a very, like a microdose essentially.
Right, right.
Of
right.
cannabis. Because sometimes, you know, life comes at you fast.
It does.
And so for somebody who I think struggles with addiction, you do have to come up with some replacement behaviors, mm-hmm. which I always argue is a huge factor in quitting anything.
Oh yeah.
Like if you don't, like if you try to quit smoking, for example, which I've done, mm-hmm. or you try to quit drinking, mm-hmm. but you're not like also at the same time getting into exercise.
Right.
Or getting into needlepoint or just something.
Something. You have to have something.
It's going
to
be hard.
Yeah.
And so,
it has to be something you like also.
Right. That you're going to be able to sustain. Mm-hmm. But if you're not struggling with addiction, and you're living a, you know, a fairly healthy life. I think mm-hmm. that's what I'm doing. I still find myself some days, especially at the end of a week, like a Friday, mm-hmm. like I'll come home and I'll be like, God, I'm so spent. Like
right.
it's like coming at you, you know? And like sometimes, you know, like I can try to meditate, but it's like, you know what? I just want to have like 2 milligrams of cannabis.
Yeah.
Like watch MSNBC, fall asleep.
just flip the switch. I mean, I'll go to a movie. Like movies are really good for that. Or a run, you know, any kind of exercise. I mean, I shop, like, you know, you just upgrade your addictions.
So you do some, yeah. Cause I have friends, who have, you know, become sober, but like different things take over and it's like,
yeah.
online shopping and,
sex is
makeup,
a big thing.
Sex is yep. a huge thing.
Yep.
But then there's like sex and love addiction.
Yeah. Which
and
is
then
a
there's
whole...
like social media addiction. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And we all have some degree of addiction.
Oh yeah. And you don't get rid of it. I mean, I know people who were alcoholics who can smoke pot or something and it doesn't trigger them. I was just never really into it. So I haven't bothered.
I'm not good at it.
No,
I'm
just
trying to find the sweet spot where like, I'm not actually that fucking stoned.
Yeah.
But then it gets stupid because I'm like, why am I even doing this? Like, I want to do it, but I don't want to feel it.
Well, I went to, so it's been legal in Washington for a while. And I went to a store recently because I wanted to get some muscle rub. And I felt really weird walking into a pot store because I was like, I should be behind the gym and someone's going to give me a baggie and I'm going to give him $40
right.
and we'll be done, you know?
Yeah.
And you walk in, there's like a yellow lab in the door being like, hello. And I was like, oh, hi. You know?
So
and,
friendly.
Yeah, so friendly.
What is this, the CBD oil? Is
that
what
yeah, it, CBD oil.
So and it doesn't have like the psychoactive property.
Right. It's like a trace amount of THC. And I said to this nice young woman, like, so I want the muscle rub, but I don't want the kind that makes you high. And she was like, oh, I have the perfect thing. This will just make you super relax and you'll fall asleep, but you won't be high. And I was like, okay, I think we have different definitions of high.
Yeah.
I want the kind with like no THC. And she was like, oh, got it. And I finally said, I'm an alcoholic, so I really don't want it. And she was like, got it. And she gave me what I needed.
Yeah.
And it's actually works like for like soft, like muscle injuries and things. It's kind of amazing. And it doesn't make you high. But yeah, that's the thing about wine too, is when people are like, I just like the taste. It's kind of like, but is there no other, do you love the taste? It's actually altering your brain. Like,
right.
And so if you,
right,
yeah, if you
bullshit.
Want, if you want to consume pot without getting stoned, it's like, why?
Yeah. Like, I just want to relax. Like, I want to, yeah. I want to take the edge off, or just like, and sometimes too, like, I think there's something, I like the idea of like, what was the verb that they used when I was reading about psychedelics.
Mm-hmm.
And it was sort of like defragging your hard drive, or
yeah,
like wiping the slate clean, almost like right. changing up my headspace.
Yeah, just kind of like yeah, like toggling a switch or something.
Yeah, yeah,
that would be wonderful. I with the book coming out and like promotion being kind of bewildering and everything new, I said to my husband recently, like I feel like I want someone to just flip me off and just turn me back on.
Yeah,
just like I do to my laptop.
That's kind of how it is. But that's a shortcut, and then there's always like there's some cost. Like you wake up a little foggier than yeah. you otherwise would have. And I can't tolerate that.
No.
I fucking hate hangovers.
Oh, yeah.
I hate them.
It's such a joke. I've been sober for over 5 years, and I still sometimes I'm like, it is so amazing, like, not to have a hangover.
Yeah.
I'll wake up occasionally if I'm dehydrated and I'll have a slight headache, and I'll have a moment of like, oh, my God, how much did I drink last night? And then right. I'm like, no, you were just a dummy who didn't drink any water.
Yeah.
You know? I love that.
But, I mean, even as a moderate drinker, I noticed, like, if I keep it to, like, a couple days a week, mm-hmm. which is what I've been doing.
Oh, yeah. That's awesome.
But the nights that I don't, because I get up very early.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't do that and be as functional as I'd like if I even have one or two glasses.
Right.
I feel them. Like, if you're getting up, if you're running your system, like, on that kind of, at that
yeah.
speed, like, getting up at 4 a.m. and stuff, you can't even have, like, if I have 2 glasses of wine at this age anyway,
yeah.
when that alarm goes off, it's not as easy to get up.
It's probably still in your system in some ways. It does impact your sleep, and, like, it puts you to sleep, but then it interrupts your sleep. And, yeah, I've had other friends say that as they age, like, even once they hit 40, they just can't,
yeah.
they feel it. I drink so much that I would kind of override that feeling, because I did have those signals in me that were like, this doesn't feel very good. And so my action, instead of stopping, was to be like, well, have another one. And then it would just override it. So I thought I was tired for like a decade. And I think I actually seriously had a low grade hangover for most of those days. I'd wake up tired and I would just think I didn't get enough sleep. But it was such a low grade hangover for the most part that I didn't recognize it as a hangover.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you get sober.
Yeah, I get sober. I stopped drinking. I didn't go to AA for no particular. I didn't even remember it existed somehow.
Therapy?
Oh, yeah, lots of therapy. I'd been in therapy already. A lot of online support. I went to this. There's a website called Tired of Thinking About Drinking. I had Googled the phrase and found this website. And this woman named Belle runs a 100-day challenge. And you just sign up for it and just say, I'm not going to drink for 100 days, and which seemed impossible. And you email her every day just to be like, still sober.
Every day.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because this is something that's interesting to me is in sobriety culture, AA, I think, is the prominent one.
Mm-hmm.
But you, there's a reason why people go to meetings every day.
Yeah. Yeah. It's accountability. It's something to do with your fucking time because you suddenly have a lot of it. And it's, I think, the key to getting sober, like the thing that's been common for me that's the AA thing is, first of all, introspection, looking at yourself, and also talking to other addicts, because I can sit down with anyone who's had an addiction issue. We could be totally, it can be a cab driver, someone I have nothing in common with, and we get each other at a fundamental level. And, and I've been to some meetings, I've sort of dabbled, I'm like a dilettante in AA, and yeah, it's kind of cool. You walk in and you're just like, huh? Yeah, I understand these people.
It's honest.
Anywhere in the world. Yeah. Anywhere.
I've been to an AA. I went to an AA meeting for book research years ago mm-hmm. in West Hollywood, and I was blown away.
Oh, like, yeah.
Just, it's powerful.
It is.
And there aren't that many spaces, you know, human gatherings where people are that honest with one another.
Yeah. And they're used to, a lot of them are used to being that honest. So they just open right up, and it's kind of incredible. I went to one, it was in the early days of the Me Too movement, and it made me feel better about men. Just because I was in this like let's just put them all in a fire heap and light it sort of mood that yeah. I've been toggling in and out of
right.
in the Trump era.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, these guys are really, I'm sure they've got their own stuff like we all do. But it was like this really intimate, vulnerable space. And I was like, oh, look, humans.
Right.
And it just made me feel so good. And I didn't need that meeting to keep me sober. But I was just like, oh, these people are just, well, they're also just people. You realize, like, if you go to meetings and there's people who've been sober for 20 years, they're not struggling day to day with whether to drink. They're just having problems, like normal human problems.
Yeah, but I think that if you don't have some sort of accountability system mm-hmm. or ritual or community, whether it's virtual or in person or therapeutic.
Yeah.
If you don't have some sort of regular reminder, you lose sight.
Yeah.
And I think you run the risk of possibly slipping.
Well, you can forget how bad it was. And I have friends who still go to AA after 30 years, primarily because they want to remember. And they want to see people who are brand new to sobriety and be like, oh, yeah, I do not want to be there again.
Isn't it amazing that you can forget?
Yeah. Yeah.
Especially for, I mean, because some people's stories are much more cinematic than yours.
Right.
You know, where
and
it's
they
like,
still forget.
I woke up in a snowbank and
yeah,
you
I
know,
got arrested.
I got arrested. I don't even remember, you mm-hmm. know, like multiple, there are some horrific stories out there. Even those people could forget.
Mm-hmm.
Like the human capacity for forgetting is formidable.
Yeah. It's really scary. I am. The night Trump was elected, I just remember it was really my big moment of truth. I'd been sober for over 3 years and
you're not the first writer to tell me that. Sober writer.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
Like the night of the 2016 election.
Yeah.
Like unsolicited, people have told me that was a night of great, like, tenuousness. Or like,
yeah.
If I was going to slip, it was going to happen then.
Of course. Like, I thought about that even beforehand because I was like, and I thought the outcome was going to be very different. But I still was like, oh, I'm going to be so nervous. And it was actually a great night for me in some ways because I had this moment of realizing, well, you could drink, but it's not actually going to change reality. He will still be president and you will wake up and you will have relapsed. And it was the harshest moment of, I don't think I really realized that wine could not alter reality until that night.
Huh.
And I was like, fuck, we're so fucked. And, but I just sat on my kitchen floor, did not drink. And woke up the next day, felt horrible.
On your floor?
Yeah.
Oh, like
yeah.
The I was tile? Like,
yeah. I was like, just sit down. My dogs are next to me. Yeah. And I didn't have, there was no booze in the house. Like, I was never actually in jeopardy. I wasn't going to go out and do it.
Yeah.
But I was like, I wanted anything to change. Because I also, my mind was panicking and I was imagining all these catastrophes, you know, some of
all
which
have come
to me. Yeah. I was saying to someone the other day, I was like, it actually turned out to be as bad as we thought and worse.
I hate to be right, but I sort of like, there's nothing that's happened where I'm like, I can't believe it.
Right. I thought for a while, oh, it'll probably just, he's a figurehead and it'll be just, you know, a standard Republican administration will suck. But no, he's actually crazy. But it was really a scary moment of realizing that even if I drank, nothing would change. And I hear people say now, like, oh, I'm going to quit once Trump is out of office. Or I start drinking a lot more.
I say that about social media.
Yeah.
I'm going to quit once this shit's over.
Once he's gone.
I'm using it right now because I need to keep up with the
Nick.
But once it's over, I'm going to just like check
just
out.
Cut the cord. Yeah. There is some reason for that. With drinking, I always say to people, like, don't let him be the one that makes that decision for you.
Mm.
Like, if you're drinking because of Trump, and you're drinking to a level that you're worried about it, like, you're just giving him your power.
He's already taken so much. Don't let him take that.
Yeah. Like drink if you want to drink, but don't do it because of him. Because there's always going to be some, like, what if Peter Thiel, the kinder, gentler, more polished Trump comes along? Like, that's going to be a pretty scene either.
Yeah.
You're just going to drink the rest of your life? I guess you could, but I wouldn't recommend it.
You know, it's like this, like the fundamental issue, I think, or at least like one way that I conceive of it is just that like the way through is through
mm-hmm.
when it comes to human pain.
Yeah. Yeah.
And for some reason, that's really hard. Well, it's hard to do.
It's terrible.
And it's hard to admit.
Yeah.
Everybody, we all have these strategies for trying to run away from our pain,
mm-hmm.
Our anxiety, our sadness, our fear, whatever it is. If you drink, if you eat an edible, CBD, mm-hmm. You know, whatever it is, social media,
mm-hmm.
reality TV, shopping, food, sex.
Yep.
Like these are,
they all work temporarily.
Temporarily.
Yeah.
But ultimately, and this is what therapy is,
mm-hmm.
you're going through it.
Right.
With a guide.
It's like a little microcosm, like a diorama of your life or something.
And and you have somebody there to kind of like prompt you and like help you through.
Yeah. Yoga is kind of good for that too. Or running. Like I feel like anything you do, the way you do things like on a yoga mat or running, or it's kind of the way you do everything. Like my impatience comes out when I'm running, you know, or my like, why isn't this easier? I'm angry about that. Well, because it's not. It's really fucking hard.
Well, you see yourself in, I guess those are both solitary activities. You're sort of trapped mm-hmm. inside, but yoga especially because, you know, you've got the meditation aspect, but you've also, you're putting yourself and your body into these like uncomfortable postures.
Yeah. And, you're kind of doing it on purpose.
And watching like the chatter in your head.
Right. Right. Which is amazing to me because I started to realize that I would immediately go into the most extreme version of a pose that I could. And then I'd be really uncomfortable. And it was like, oh, interesting. That's exactly what I do at work. And, you know, in any aspect of my life. And so I still do that, but now I know I'm doing it.
You get, like, you get competitive at yoga.
Yeah.
You're like, gotta be amazing at this.
Yeah. Yeah. Like I don't want to suck at yoga. Yeah. But yeah, I think that pain will do anything to avoid it. You actually can't. And there's no like happy answer. I mean, people are like, your book is inspiring. And I'm like, really? Because I don't think so. I stopped doing one thing, you know, and I'm an infinitely happier person now. But
that's inspiring.
Yeah.
And it's not easy to stop.
No, it was very, very, you know what? It was hard for me to stop, but I started feeling better really fast. I think I knew within 2 weeks that what I had suspected for a whole decade had been correct, that I needed to quit drinking. And so it was a lot easier for me than some people. It's still uncomfortable. You have to go through like the first Christmas and visit home. And
well, but let's talk about that.
Yeah.
I've been meaning to get to that, but I wanted to kind of hear the story first. But the navigating the social aspects of being a newly sober person mm-hmm. or just being a sober person, period. Mm-hmm. Or like sometimes I run into this where like, I just don't feel like drinking.
Yeah.
And if like I go out some nights and I'm with my buddies or you're with like, and it's like, would you like some wine? Mm-hmm. No, I'm good. Just the water. And then everyone's like, well, why aren't you drinking?
Even I'm like, really?
Yeah. Or like I'll have an iced tea or, you know what I'm mm-hmm. saying? Like, but you feel a social pressure. And then if you don't, then everyone like it kind of brings the room down and everyone, like, then one other person will be like, you know what? I'm not going to either. And then other people are like feeling guilty for the fact that they did. And
everyone's watching them.
And I'm like, you know what? Let me just do my thing. I don't give a fuck. Like, take right. care of yourself. Like, I don't want to hear, you know, I'm not policing anybody. I just don't want to have anything to drink.
It's so weird. It's yeah. so weird. I was actually out to lunch with my publishing team in New York last week. And I was so relieved when someone ordered a glass of wine because like, I just want people to do their thing.
Yeah.
You know,
like, if you're with a sober person, they don't want you. I mean, I guess maybe some do, but like most of my friends who are like officially sober,
right.
they don't want you to not have a drink because they're at the table. Then right. it just makes everybody feel weird.
It's weird. And there's some people, I think if they're really newly sober who maybe can't handle that or something, but you know, most of us, if you're going to live in the world, like there's a lot of booze in the world and you might not hang out in bars, but I'm actually fine going to a bar except for the fact that people are annoying when they're drunk. But,
yeah,
it's so strange. I think like if I were allergic to shellfish and I went to a restaurant with friends and said, no, I'm just having a salad or something. Nobody would be like, oh, let's have one shrimp. Maybe you won't go into anaphylactic shock. They would never do that. But with booze, it makes people really uncomfortable.
Well, this is what I think. I think that deep down, a lot of us feel, I mean, I'm the poster child for this, where I'm thinking like, you know, if you're self-aware.
Yeah.
And if you're interested in this issue of consumption mm-hmm. and if you're interested in your feelings mm-hmm. and like you're cognizant of your pain or whatever and how you're dealing with it, I think a lot of us feel a sense of maybe I should tone it down or maybe this isn't the best way.
It's like ambivalent drinking.
Yeah. And then, but ambivalent consumption across the board, like maybe I shouldn't be staring at my phone.
Right.
Maybe
right.
I shouldn't be on amazon.com like looking mm-hmm. at, you know, whatever.
Stuff I don't need that I can get delivered in an hour.
It just feels, it's hard not to look at the state of things. Like, for example, climate.
Mm-hmm.
That's, to me, that's like the most hardcore manifestation of our consumption problem.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, we're killing ourselves. We're destroying our own environment. And so I think it's not an exaggeration to say that like a radical rethinking is in order.
Mm-hmm. Well, because it's also, I think people feel powerless. Like when I think about climate change, I can almost, and you know, in Seattle this summer, we were breathing smoke for a couple of weeks, and which you guys do down here. And I was like, oh, this feels really real. Like, I don't know if those fires were directly caused by climate change, but you know, they were not uncaused by them. And then you feel powerless. I was like, well, what can I do right now? There's nothing I can do.
Well, there is though. I think changing the...
Change one habit,
but like the way that you consume.
Yeah.
Like the way that we consume food.
Mm-hmm. Beef contributes to climate change.
Like if you're participating in industrial meat production, that has a huge impact mm-hmm. on the clear cutting of forests and water, water pollution because mm-hmm. of the runoff and the pesticides and chemicals that go into feeding the livestock.
Yeah.
And, it's like all tied together.
Even cut down one time a week. I mean, that's
public transportation.
Yeah.
Biking. Yeah. Recycling. You mm-hmm. do all those kinds of things.
Start composting.
You can start to have, if we all did that.
Right.
But there is the power of one.
Yeah. And I think people, and I tend to think of these grand actions, I need to go live on a mountaintop and not consume anything. I mean, this is great alcoholic thinking. Like you're either Hummer or I'm saying, yeah. And I think people, so you get this feeling of like, well, I'm panicked. I don't know what to do. And it's like, I just want to make something take the edge off. And of course, I mean, people are like, don't you miss having something to take the edge off? Absolutely. But it just can't be alcohol for me anymore. It's running or shopping.
Most of your friendships survived the transition?
They did.
Your family relationships, your husband. I know you write about him in the book. And
yeah. He actually ended up quitting too. He quit about 6 months later. He was super supportive. And he just decided to quit. He'll be 5 years in about a month.
Was his drinking similar to yours?
Yeah, if not worse. But we didn't know it. Because we got along great. We always had. And so we thought we were fine. I mean, we look back and we're like, oh, that's adorable. Yeah. Incredibly codependent human beings.
Right.
And we're both just like so much happier now. But we're lucky that our relationship, it's even better now. Because a lot of people, either one person doesn't get sober and the other person can't deal with it.
Yeah.
Or they get sober and then realize they're moving in totally different directions. So I think some marriages don't survive. I was a little older. I think I was 43 when I quit drinking. So by that point, most of my friends, I thought everybody was drinking just like I was, but that was not really true. a lot of them were, but I looked around and I was like, okay, these are more rational people. So I talked to people in their 20s who are getting sober. That's tough, or college students where people really are going out and partying like maniacs. So I was able, I didn't lose any friendships that were important to me. I can tell you that.
But you'd have to go work functions.
Yeah.
And everyone's doing the wine. You have to be because the thing is at some point the conversation inevitably comes up, I would imagine.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, you're having a club soda.
Right.
And maybe people don't say anything because they're not going to be like, are you sober?
Right.
Eventually, it probably came up, right?
Yeah, especially because I was known for drinking, for being part of the drinking crowd. And I would just say something like, oh, I just decided to take a break or something. And they would usually know enough to just be like, oh, okay, cool. And often people just don't care as much as you think they will. Like if it's not someone who knows you well, they're just like, okay.
I think too, people, in my experience, when somebody gets sober and if you actually say it, I had to stop.
Yeah.
People tend to be like, that's awesome.
Yeah.
And then sometimes you'll get like, I should probably do that too.
I had a ton of that. They would be like, that's fantastic, which is great. It's even if it's just a polite, nice, supportive thing to say, it's just nice. Like people would say congratulations. And that made me really happy because it was like an achievement. It was like I'd achieved something.
You got an S.
Yeah. I got the S, S plus even. And then often they'd be like, I should think about it. Or they'd say, my mother has been sober for 10 years, but she drank a lot when I was growing up. Like everybody's got a story.
Sure.
And that was kind of cool. I also realized, Amazon's a tech company. There's lots and lots of people, especially in the tech end, who came to Seattle from India. And a lot of people who grew up in India don't drink. They're Muslim, they're Hindu. So I started.
But they microdose, which is huge.
Do they? They might be microdosing.
Probably are now, trying to keep up with Bezos.
Exactly, right.
He's ripped. Right. He's juicing for sure.
It's so weird. He wasn't like that when I first got to Amazon. He looked kind of just regular.
He was like a geek.
Yeah.
Now he's like geek to freak. You know?
He'd been kind of heavy in the early, way early, not really, but a softer guy. And then when I got there, he was just skinny. And now, like, I saw that photo. I would see him maybe 5 or 6 times a year, so not a lot.
But just like biohacking.
Ripped. It's crazy.
But see, biohacking to me feels like that's the void, trying to fill that void.
Mm-hmm.
And it also, that hyper-competitive office culture, and like that bro culture, all of a sudden I'm seeing the hockey team fighting in the yard.
Oh, totally.
And it's like, I'm going to biohack
cryotherapy. I'm going to freeze my body.
I'm going to, you know, I'm trying to think of all the different things that there's a certain bro culture that's like deep into it.
It's a Tim Ferriss kind of thing.
Sure. And I'm going to get a competitive edge, and I'm going to make more money, and I'm going to work less hours somehow.
Yeah.
I'm going to need less sleep.
Right. You're still going to die.
It's like, dude. But it's like, at some point, I'm just like, shut the fuck up and live your life.
Did you see this thing that came out about Mark Wahlberg this week? It's his workout routine.
No.
It is insane. It's on Instagram, I think. He gets up at 2 a.m. by 3, and then he prays for like half an hour. So like Mark Wahlberg at 2:30 a.m, just think about this next time you're awake. He's out there praying. Which is, I mean, good for him. That's fine.
Well, I mean, the Dalai Lama gets up at 3:45. I think people.
But he's the Dalai Lama.
He's the, yeah. But like this brings up such, like, this is the question for me. Like, how do you live a good life?
Mm-hmm.
And by good life, I mean like a wise life.
Right.
How do you actually get to a place of peace and equanimity? Am I saying that right?
Equanimity.
Yeah. And happiness. You know what I'm saying? Like, what's the path?
Yeah.
I mean, is it getting up at 2 and like going into the gym?
Right.
Is it,
For some people.
Maybe.
I feel like it's like when I got sober, and I think it's like this for a lot of people, it's actually a route to uncovering who you really are and what you really want. And you can't hate yourself into it. You have to actually learn to be nice to yourself, or you're just not going to make it. And so for me, I think my life got a lot better because I had to actually learn to be nice to myself for the first time in my life. And that sometimes it means silly things like, you know, buying myself a new pair of shoes that I don't really need. That's relatively less harmless than drinking. And sometimes it's actually things like, yeah, I don't want to go to that party, so I'm not going to. Like giving myself time and space, making sure I get enough sleep. Like it forced
not beating yourself up for like past mistakes.
Yeah. I mean, I really try not to. Or if there's, you know, there's this thing in AA where you make amends, where you actually think, are there places where I can make amends where it's not just about me and it's not going to hurt the other person more, where you can actually go and say, hey, I did this thing.
That's powerful to me.
I know.
I love amends. It's terrifying, but it's like super powerful.
Yeah. I'm going to do the steps at some point. And that's kind of the reason, like the moral inventory sounds really fun. Especially the sexual inventory. I love that idea. I'm like, that would be a great essay.
Right. I was going to say, you did your moral inventory. It's sitting here in this
book.
Yeah,
exactly. Because I rake myself over the coals plenty. But then to actually make amends is like, ooh, I don't want to do that. It's not because I don't think I owe anyone an apology. It's because I don't, you know, necessarily want to make it. But I've done kind of my version of that.
Well, I have a friend, and I don't think this friend would mind, especially since I'm not going to name this friend.
Uh-huh.
I won't even genderize this friend. I have a friend who in high school got fucked up with some friends and wound up vandalizing some house, like some suburb, you know, and 6-7 years later got sober. And as part of the amends process, went to this house, rang the doorbell and was like, that was me.
Wow.
I'm sorry. What do I owe you?
Wow.
And they were like $15,000 or something like that.
Yeah.
And
they weren't just like, hey, thanks for telling us.
Right. My friend was like, oh shit. Okay. Can we do this in installments?
Right. Yeah. That's the problem, is you have to be prepared for the fact that there's might be actual consequences, or that people are just like, fuck you, get out of here.
Yeah.
It's not always a movie, like a Will Smith movie, where they're like, this is powerful.
Well, it's like, it's weird when it comes to amends and apologies, because, you know, sometimes you're saying you're sorry and you just really want that absolution.
Mm-hmm.
You want the person to say that it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
Or thank you for apologizing. We're going to put this behind us, and you can, you know, you want that emotional release, but that can't be what it's about.
No.
It's about you saying you're sorry and letting them have space to do it and feel however, you know.
Exactly. You do what you can, and then you really can't control the outcome. I mean, I heard this phrase the other day from a sober guy, a sober chef, about investing in the loss. I'd never heard this phrase, but it was like you let go of the outcome and you just invest in whatever is going to happen, even if you end up losing something.
Yeah.
And I thought, that sounds beautiful. I don't really want to do it. I want my own way, but.
Well, and I think that you can't, it makes sense to me that you can't fully like get emotionally and psychologically healthy in the absence of some kind of process like that, particularly mm-hmm. if you went way off the rails.
Right.
And like, you know, destroyed your family life or hurt
your children's
people.
Lives. Or,
yeah.
I was fortunate in that, you know, I didn't have those kinds of stories, although I'm sure I did subtle damage to people. But yeah, if you've really, really hurt people or, you know, vandalized, I mean, someone had to spend $15,000 on their house. Like that's a big deal. And I'm sure emotionally it hurt them and it made them feel violated.
Because it was like, who did this?
Yeah. It's scary.
It was scary. It was like, did somebody hate us? Like,
is there something about our identity? Is it like, they didn't know it was just some stupid kid.
Right. And then like lived with that for 6 years.
Right.
So
right.
It was worth it for them to hear and probably brought closure all the way around.
Right. They were like, it's just some idiot, but we still, you know, would like real amends.
But can you imagine? I mean, I'm trying to think if something like that happened to me and then somebody came, I think my heart would be touched. I'd be like, oh, this person mm-hmm. is a good person.
Right.
You know, I would have forgiveness. I'd probably want my money back too.
Sure. Yeah. 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 But yeah, that someone would actually come to you. I would be impressed. I think they didn't have to do this.
No.
This was probably really hard and scary. They actually came in person.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's pretty ballsy.
Hard to outsource that.
No.
Task rabbit.
I mean, yes, very hard.
Would you mind going to this house as my representative?
Right. Here's a little thing on a popsicle stick you can hold up in front of your face.
Oh, man.
Do you think he was hoping that it was like different people who lived there?
I mean, who knows? But I think like ultimately it's probably a good thing because otherwise there would be no, if they had moved away or something, there would be hard to get that closure.
Right.
And to have made that apology.
Right. But, yeah. Your friend knows that they've done that now.
You know, and it's like, I think we've all done subtle damage. Mm-hmm. We've all done damage to other people.
Oh, yeah. Sober or not. I mean,
and it's so hard to know how much do you owe in terms of amends?
Mm-hmm.
Like, how much guilt does a person carry before things start to get unhealthy?
Right.
And when do you actually owe somebody like that kind of grand action? Where
like
you go
formal.
Like a formal mm-hmm. thing versus just understanding that you made a mistake, that you did some subtle damage or you hurt somebody somehow
mm-hmm.
and resolving to be better.
Right.
And is that enough? Do you
right.
see what I'm saying? Like the balance between those two things. I never know. Like, I think in my head, I'm like, I really wish I could just go back and every single person that, you know, I ever did anything to, if I could just get a hold of them, we could Skype it out.
Right. Well, yeah, because I've had people apologize to me for things that, like, I have no memory of.
And
I'm totally fine with that person. And it's clearly serious to them. And I'm like, I almost feel bad being like, I don't remember this thing that's clearly really important to you.
Yeah.
But it's fine. But I always think of, so in Magnolia, the movie, there's this scene where Jason Robards is dying and people are always talking about like, don't have regrets, don't have shame. And he's like, no, use your regret. It's this really powerful moment.
Yeah.
And it's like, take your regrets and make them whip you into shape in some ways. And so I think it's a really fine line. I think about that a lot, actually, because I'm like trying to be a decent person and I think about it all the time. Yeah.
But I think that's true. Like, I think you have to use that stuff. And you have to be aware of the mistakes that you've made. Otherwise, how are you going to get better? How are you going to not make those same mistakes? And
yeah, because they drag, even if it's a selfish thing, like hurting people drags you down too, unless you're, you know, a sociopath, which most people are not, thank God. It's, you know, you can write off a couple like in bad circumstances, but if you're constantly treating people badly, I think it just makes you. Like in yoga, the yamas and niyamas, they're not to make you some sort of pure being. They're to make you happier.
Wait, what's the yamas and niyamas?
They're like the things you should do and should not do. So there's like five of each. I used to be able to rattle them off. But it's like being truthful, not stealing.
Don't gossip.
Yeah.
Stuff like that.
Being like clean. And it seems like not stealing. It's not just because stealing is wrong. It's because like if you're stealing, you're probably not going to be, unless you're just amoral, you're not going to be happy.
Right.
So it's really for you and living by your own values. I mean, I think that's what it comes down to is you have to figure out what's important to you whatever that is, as long as it's not like arson or something, you know.
Arson is hugely important to me.
Right. Then maybe you shouldn't live by your values. But so that's what my therapist helped me figure out. Like, when are you living by your values? And I think you could feel it. Like, a lot of us are really disconnected from our bodies, but I think that you can learn to like feel it in your body. That's how I know if I need to like actually apologize to someone. I think I can sense it.
There's like a physical manifestation.
I think so. That's hard to feel, or I'll feel, or if I'm around them frequently, I can sort of feel this vibe, and usually I'm not wrong.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you apologize, and the apology's never as hard as you think it's going to be. Because the worst thing that happens is they act ungracious about it.
Or they're just like, what are you talking about?
Right,
we
right.
Were,
like,
we were in high
nothing.
School.
No yeah, one, exactly. Like, no one we gave were a seven. Shit. Like, whatever.
That's me. I'm still hanging on to like right. The shit I did when I was like seven, you know, 16 or 14. Or it's like, dude.
But are you still mad about stuff people did to you when you
no.
were seven?
No. Exactly. I'm like, dude, it's okay. Like, you know, we're all human.
There's a girl who bullied me when I was 12, and we're Facebook friends now, and I still kind of hate her.
I mean, you know, like there is like if you can get back inside that pain a little bit.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, I'm capable. But like, I think bigger picture, like if that same person was like, I was just diagnosed with a horrible illness, you'd be right. Like, oh, my God, I'm so sorry. You OK?
Right. And I would mean it.
And, yeah. And you would mean it. So it's like, you know, it's very easy to get back inside. But I think when it comes to big picture stuff, like it's, you know, it falls away.
Right, right. But the fact that you are still holding yourself accountable for stuff you did when you were a kid, that, you know, people probably, you were a different person.
I know. And it's like, I think I have this, you know, it's a good thing. It's like, again, it's a fine line between self-awareness and holding yourself to high standards, which isn't a bad thing.
No, it's
like,
good.
High standards of behavior, wanting to actually work at my spiritual life, for lack of a better term. Mm-hmm. Like, think about the big stuff. Uh-huh. Why are we here? What's the best way to live?
Right.
How should I be consuming? How should I treat people? Mm-hmm. How should I treat myself? Mm-hmm. What should I do with my work life?
And your time.
And my time. Mm-hmm. Like, how should I earn my living? And what are the consequences of it?
Yeah.
You know, like all these things.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's a lot to consider. And I think the fine line is like between, you know, engaging with that stuff honestly and consistently. And then like over-obsessing about it or hanging on too tight
or dangerous part,
beating yourself up. And
yeah. If you can't take any action, like if you get so wrapped around the axle that you can't do anything, then that's when, and I think we can all get to that. If anyone who's thinking honestly about these things can get to the point where it's like, I literally can't make a non-harmful action in this world. You can get kind of frozen.
That's why I like meditation.
Yeah.
Because it's like, sit down, shut the fuck up.
Yeah.
That's it.
That's it.
It's not easy, but it's like,
I keep trying to get better at it. It's so, I've done yoga for so long. Like, I'm the type of person who should, and I do like it. Every time I do it, I'm like, oh, that's nice. I'm glad I meditated. But I just never want to do it. So
it's
stopping. Yeah. I need to bribe myself or something. I need to actually have like a chore chart.
Yoga's meditation. It's just, you're moving. Because I do,
you know, meditation sometimes.
It is. Yeah. Smoking. It just involves like 5,000. I always joke. It's the same thing as meditation. People have like a smoke break.
Yeah.
They're going outside to just like breathe for a second.
Yeah.
But they're breathing poison.
I had a friend who said when she quit smoking, the hardest thing was she would smoke when she was arguing like with her teenage son. And it was a chance to pause because she would like inhale, smoke. And and suddenly that was gone.
Yeah.
And that was the hardest thing is she had to just engage with him like a tennis match. And I thought, wow, that's really, I mean, I only smoked for like a year, you know, in my late teens.
It's the worst.
Oh, so gross. I was so amazing. Gross. Like I quit. I was like, I'm done.
Huh.
It was really easy. So you wouldn't think I would have ended up being an addict in other ways.
Interesting.
Know? Yeah. Yeah.
Because like a lot of times people who give up alcohol or drugs or whatever, like they'll be nicotine.
Oh yeah.
Like as a replacement.
Right away. In fact, I'll hear from people sometimes who are like, so today I quit drinking, smoking, sugar, and carbs, and also I start training for a marathon. And I'm like, okay, Missy, you need to go bring back at least two of those things right now.
Okay, sugar and carbs. I want to talk about this.
Yeah.
Like, I get it. Like, white bread, like, in mass, you know, and like binge eating candy. Like, okay.
Right.
But can we calm down on, like, not eating any carbohydrates and, like, never having a sweet?
Right, right.
Like, live your life.
Sugar is poison. I have a friend who's trying to, like, improve. She's sober and trying to improve her relationship with food. And she was like, I won't call sugar a poison anymore. She said, it doesn't have nutritional value. That's different from being a poison. It's just such a sick, that all or nothing thinking is killing us.
I mean, yeah. And it's like, I don't know. I just feel like having a little chocolate.
No, it's like I have chocolate almost every day.
I do have chocolate every day.
Yeah, it's really good.
Like not a ton.
Right, right. The chocolate. And mine's not always, the darkest chocolate either. Like it's not, I'm getting the antioxidants. No, I like the way it tastes.
Oh, wait, you don't eat dark chocolate?
I do, but I eat milk chocolate too.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That's fucked up.
I love milk chocolate.
You're going off the rails.
It's delicious. It is sweeter. Well, people, so the thing, when people get sober, they tend to like dive into a vat of ice cream. Oh. I certainly did. And then you're like, why am I not losing weight? That's
sugar.
So strange.
Because there is there's a sugar thing happening with alcohol.
Yeah. And you don't necessarily realize it. And then, also I just wanted to like treat myself because I was the kind of person who wouldn't eat. I would like to use my calories on alcohol.
Oh.
So I was like, well, there's a lot of incredible ice cream in the world. Like it's innovative ice cream, basic ice cream.
It's cutting edge.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very good. But yes, sugar is definitely a thing. So when people quit drinking and sugar on the same day, I mean, some people have to do it that way. And that works. It's like detoxing from heroin. It sucks. And then you're fine. But normally I'm like, okay, go. It's the only time I'll tell someone like, go get a fucking cigarette. Do not quit drinking and smoking on the same day.
Yeah.
Because you're going to need something. You can't hate yourself or punish yourself into getting sober.
That's a good point.
Or staying sober. You'll be white knuckling it. You have to actually like yourself enough to do it and like yourself enough to know that you're doing something hard that doesn't feel fun right away. But that it's going to be like loving yourself sometimes means doing something that doesn't feel pleasant.
Do you have, or did you, as an outgrowth of getting sober, develop like a richer, like spiritual life the way that a lot, because in AA, it's not like you got to be Christian, but there is the God thing or the something bigger than myself.
The higher power.
That's right.
It's funny because Seattle is such a secular city and people just kind of rattle through that like in the Pledge of Allegiance, how you're like one nation under God. And I can just say that stuff and it doesn't mean anything to me. I did. Like I'm agnostic. I'm not a hardcore atheist. So like lately I've been drifting in that direction. I think anytime you get to know yourself better and to, like actually have to think about your place in the world and how you live your life, it's hard not to become more spiritual and creativity also. I mean, I think that the fact that I'm actually writing now after I took 12 years off, and came back to it. Like you're tapping into something bigger for sure.
Yeah. And then ritual too.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm really grateful for that. I mean, that's been the best thing.
And the yoga.
Yeah. Yeah. And the yoga.
How much are you doing of that?
Not much anymore. Cause I run a lot. I did yoga very competitively. And you can actually do competitive yoga. It's a thing.
Yeah. No, I remember like watching some documentary on Bikram or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe like in India, he's a lunatic.
He's a nut job.
Yeah.
I did yoga like 6 times a week for 10 years.
So did I.
Really?
Yeah.
It's fun. I mean,
I hurt myself though.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. I like eventually my back couldn't, I was just repetitive stress.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I started studying Iyengar yoga, which is very alignment based.
Uh-huh.
And I think it's the reason I never had a major injury.
It's smart. Cause I was doing all that like vinyasa.
Yeah.
Where you're snapping through all these poses.
Yeah. And it's usually in the transitions that people get hurt because you're not thinking of it as a time. You're like, oh, I'm going from A to B.
Yeah.
But,
you're not being careful or.
Right. Iyengar is great because it's like they are very, it's literally like turn your outer left knee in.
And you hold those poses forever.
Forever. Yeah.
It's hard.
Yeah. It's really hard. But it was, so when I moved to Seattle, this is in Ann Arbor, which is like this decades long center for Iyengar yoga. But in Seattle,
BKS where it's, Iyengar?
Yeah.
What does BKS stand for?
I don't remember.
Bob, Kevin, Sam Iyengar.
Bob, Keith, Seth. That would be awesome.
Bob Iyengar.
Bob
had
Iyengar.
A huge impact on
maybe
the world.
Maybe Shri in there somewhere. Who knows?
Yeah.
But they would literally, like I remember doing mountain pose where you're standing and the senior teacher was like, brought me up to show everyone how I didn't do it right. I was like, I don't even know how to stand.
You got the end.
Yeah. And they hit you with sticks and stuff. But once I got to Seattle and it's all just flow with the music. Oh, and by the way, it's 109 degrees in this room.
Uh-huh.
I did see people get hurt a lot and I was able to basically, mostly not get hurt, but I want to get back and do it more. When I took up running and I was working full time, I started running cause I needed exercise I could do at any time of day. And without having to show up at a class.
Plus, it's like, if you run for 15 minutes,
mm-hmm.
Like you just ran 2 miles or.
Yeah, well, you know, maybe you did.
Mile and a half.
Yeah.
Half
yeah.
a mile. Okay. But I was running.
For me, it'd be like a mile. Yeah, like almost a mile and a half.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's efficient.
I'm always thinking like that. Sometimes you got to fit it in. But
yeah.
My body's not good at running.
No, mine's not either, actually. I've been doing it for 6 years.
It's hard on you, man.
It's rough. And I got injured a lot at first until I learned. Eventually, I beat myself up enough that I ended up in physical therapy a couple times. And I realized, like, you can. There's very few people who have that, like, runner's body.
I envy those people.
I know. Very, very thin, very lithe. You know, like, I used to work with a guy, a sort of slight Asian guy who had like that classical runner's body, and he was an elite athlete, and he would take like 10-mile training runs like 4 times a week. And I run like 3 miles at a time.
That's Jeff Bezos now.
Yeah. Except he's too pumped. I wonder what he does.
He's got trainers.
Oh yeah. I mean, he could have like live-in trainers. I want to see his home gym. I wonder if he would let me just,
he's biohacking for sure.
He's got to be, I wonder if he has his own cryo chamber.
I'm telling you, I can look at that guy and be like, he is deep into biohacking. Yeah.
And it's so weird because he's so super normal in a lot of ways. Like all the people are like, oh, he's so mean. Like he's funny. He's a nice guy. But yeah, like there's got to be some serious shit going on.
I'm sure there's normal, but like any billionaire.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's like at what point? Like I feel like I don't understand those kinds of people. Like, just stop, dude. You did it. Like,
right.
go live your life.
I think they're obsessed. I think it's a certain mindset where you just can't stop. Like, you want to do bigger and bigger and bigger things.
You want to maintain.
You've proven you can do it. You know, like, you can do these insane things. Like, why not do some other insane thing? That's why I keep wishing he would, like, tackle health insurance in
okay.
America.
Because he just announced that he's giving, like, what, $20 billion or $2 billion
to start, yeah.
To, like, preschool and to something else.
Homelessness and preschool.
And yeah. You know, I will clap for that all mm-hmm. day long. I don't know why his total net worth is what, like $50 billion or something?
Yeah, he's the richest man on earth, which is super weird to be in a room with and be like, that's you. It's really weird.
You've been in a room with him.
Oh, yeah. I mean, many times.
Many times. And just been like, wow, that's the richest guy on the planet.
Yep. It's the first time I met him, he sat next to me in a meeting and I was like, this is, you know, 12 years ago. And I was like, you've been on the cover of Time magazine.
Yeah.
I didn't say it. I just thought it. It was like just really surreal.
Yeah, you're not friends, though.
No, I think he knows. I mean, he knew my name, but you know, we weren't friends.
That's not nothing.
No, exactly. Exactly.
You must have done well at Amazon.
Yeah,
Jeff Bezos knew your name.
I did.
We didn't biohack together or anything.
No, we didn't. I haven't been in his cryo chamber.
Yeah, I was going to say, you guys didn't go in his float tank together.
Oh, I bet he does have his own float tank.
There's no doubt in my mind he's got a float tank.
Yeah.
He's got multiple float tanks.
I thought at one point, so he has this thing, this is public, like people who are basically his shadows. He'll have a person who basically follows him, goes to all his meetings with him, and for a year or two, and they're kind of operating as like his second brain, you know? And they're thinking, and these are people who are like really high potential people at Amazon, and they're thinking about like other ideas or things he might not have thought of or asking questions. And when I first met his first shadow, I just figured it was like a ninja. I thought it was a bodyguard because this guy just sat there and never really said anything. And he was very bespectacled and kind of, you know, just this white guy. But I was like, no, I bet he's secretly a ninja.
Dude's got like 3 master's degrees from Yale.
Yeah. And he actually, this particular one was an ex-Marine, it turned out, which I never would have guessed. But I was just positive that was just security.
That's actually a smart, I mean, thinking about all the decisions that probably, you know, funnel through Jeff Bezos' life. And all that, you know, because like when you're you're running that kind of empire, that's hard.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know,
I mean, he's brilliant, but no one's that smart.
Yeah, it's almost like you need an extra hard drive.
It's kind of how it operates. And it's considered like a really plum assignment.
Sure.
But it's also like, I don't think most people don't do it for more than a year because you travel. I think you travel with them. Like you're basically, I don't know, it would make a great like.
How many does he have? Does he just have one?
One. And then other execs in the company have started that practice too. So like
that would be sort of a funny like comedy, The Shadow.
Yeah, The Shadow. It's the name is like technical advisor, which doesn't really make any sense because I was like, is this guy advising him on like how to use his computer, how technology works? But it's The Shadow. And sometimes they have their own projects on the side. Like I had a friend who worked for Jeff Wilkie, who is like Bezos' second in command as his shadow, and she had her own. he actually had a woman do it. Jess only had one woman shadow, but she
I want to get a shadow.
Yeah.
If anybody listening wants to be my shadow.
I know. I was like, I want a shadow.
Have a podcast guest come over and I'll just have somebody sitting to my left.
Right. It's kind of like, yeah. I have a friend who did it for a while and he said, it's basically like you're the world's fanciest secretary.
Right.
You know, and this is someone who had been like the head of our office in China, you know, and then he's like, I basically just follow Jeff around all day and go to meetings.
Pressure though. The pressure seems intense.
Yeah.
Like you got to really pay attention and you got to be on your best behavior.
You're listening for what he's not hearing and you're,
And can you ever be yourself? Like, did you ever feel like I'm really just hanging with Jeff? Like, you're always sort of performing. You want to be like, you know, like.
Always.
It's so hard to have like normal human relationships in a work context, like, especially with like the richest man on the planet.
Yeah. Yeah. There were plenty of people, including VPs I had, where I'd feel like we were just hanging out, just chatting sometimes, but no, not with him.
But even then, there's always like that one element of like, I hope I don't say something offensive that they make that are like telling everybody.
Tell the wrong joke.
Yeah.
Or something. Yeah.
Which I'm very capable of.
Oh, yeah, me too. I remember once, like, we were chatting with Jeff before a meeting, and I don't remember how this came up, but I mentioned that I think the third track on an album is usually the best. And he thought about that, and he was like, you're right. And, like, I still remember that 10 years later. He laughed. He laughed that, like, that famous laugh. And,
wait, what is his laugh?
It's this really loud laugh that comes out of nowhere. Oh, and
I didn't know this. I've never heard him laugh.
Yeah, it's this big. It's kind of like he's gotten kind of notorious for this, and it's this very big like you know laugh, and it kind of just appears, and it's sort of infectious. Some people say it's frightening. I never found it frightening.
I'm terrified right now.
But you could hear it down the hall or something. But I was like, oh my God, you know, I said something that Jeff Bezos like made him stop and think, and I felt very good about that.
I want to interview him.
Yeah.
I'll write him a letter. I'm sure he'll read it. Come down, Jeff, on your plane. Bring your shadow.
You never know. So you can email. It's just like Jeff at Amazon or something. So customers would email him directly, especially if they were having a problem they couldn't get resolved. And there is like, I think it's a staff of people who read those letters. And there's this famous Jeff question mark email where he'll, if he sees one where he's like, what the fuck? He'll figure out the right person to send it to in the company. And it's just a question mark, which basically means like,
fix this.
Yeah. And people, it can mean a whole team spends, you know, the next 3 days scrambling, not just to fix it, but to figure out what happened.
Yeah.
And there'll be this very elaborate email sent back to him saying, here's what happened. And, you know, usually it's complicated processes. It's not usually people. It's something went wrong in the system. And here's how we're fixing it. And it's one of those came to my team like the week I got to Amazon, and I was just, it was amazing to watch this.
Everybody spring into action.
Frenzy. Yeah. And then other people further down the chain start like doing them too. And it's like, no, you really gotta,
you can
get away with that if you're a certain, if you're like maybe 10 people in the company.
But see, the thing is though, is that when you're a person like that, you're worth that much money. I guess it's the same thing with fame too. Mm-hmm. Does anybody give it to you straight? I guess you might have some close friends. You better have some close friends and some family who can just tell you when you're being an asshole.
Yeah, you would hope so. I mean, a lot of the highest leaders at Amazon have been there for like, you know, 20 years. I think it's unusual.
That actually speaks well to Jeff. Mm-hmm. I'm like, whenever there's somebody who is, you know, achieved a lot and, you know, is in a position of power,
mm-hmm.
and the people around them, and they have a lot of people around them who've been there for the long haul.
Yeah.
That seems to indicate that he's not like a complete monster.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I think there's an incredible amount of loyalty, and it's not like these people, I mean, Amazon is, you know, you're in that kind of job. It's highly lucrative, but it's not like these people, again, they don't need to make any more money. I think he has such ambition, whether that's for good or ill, you know, there's a lot of controversy about that. I think it's both. But he will let, if you want to do insane things, you know, and be well-funded to do them and be able to launch projects that can be misunderstood for a long time. Like that's the place to be. And I think so he attracts people who want it. Like I worked on Amazon Go, you know, this new line of supermarkets where you literally just walk in, take what you want, leave. And, I can't imagine anywhere else on earth that I would have been able to do that and have someone be like, yeah, you know, we're going to fund it and people can find it confusing at first and we're patient. And
I think you have to be like that. By the way, this conversation has gone from like alcohol, drugs, sobriety to like Let's talk about Jeff.
Right. What's he really?
But Amazon is a fascinating topic, and I think it's applicable or of interest to a lot of writers and book people. Mm-hmm. But, if you're thinking about a company of that size and scale and wanting it to remain vital, any mm-hmm. company that becomes big enough.
Yeah.
I think if you don't actively and aggressively pursue experimental behaviors, then mm-hmm. you become monolithic and stuck in your ways, and you run the risk of becoming Blockbuster Video.
Oh yeah. It gets really hard to turn a ship around at some point. I remember early on, because when I got to Amazon, there were probably 5,000 employees in Seattle, which seemed overwhelming to me. And now I think there's something like 40,000. And I remember Jeff Wilkie one day saying, you know, there's going to be a point where we can't turn this thing around quickly. We can't make decisions in an agile way. And that definitely, I mean, it's much more bureaucratic than it used to be because it's massive. I mean, you have to have those structures. But it still takes massive, massive risks, which, you know, I found really exciting. But it spoils you, because I would hear about other companies like startups who were playing it too safe. And I would think, well, why don't you just let this play out for another 5 years. And I think, right, because they don't all have Amazon's pocketbooks.
I was going to say, if you're loaded the way that Amazon's loaded, you can push, you know, a couple hundred million off to the side and be like, this is just the fun money.
Right, exactly, you know? Exactly. Like, so we could do these crazy things. And of course, you know, Amazon also was very frugal, and there'd be a point that he'd be like, okay, this is stupid, or this is not working. We need to take it, usually not trash the idea, but like, what's the part of this that works and where can it go? But yeah, so I would get very impatient with other companies and be like, they're just not ambitious enough. And I was like, no. They don't have any money. Because that's how the world works. You've been in a very, very strange place where there's a huge amount of cash flow.
Where was it coming from, though? Because Amazon was not profitable forever.
Yeah, it wasn't profitable until... It took a long time.
Like recently.
Yeah.
It finally went into the black just a couple years ago.
Yeah, maybe within my tenure. Yeah.
It's because of you, by the way.
It's probably because of me.
You tipped it.
I tipped it. They were like, thank God.
You're welcome,
here.
Jeff.
Right.
Mic drop.
Right. Like a tip. I don't know. I think it's partly that it's so diversified now. You know, there's like the web service. Like when I got there, it was a retail company.
Yeah.
And it was already world famous. But now there's, you know, web services and Amazon Studios, which is actually making really good stuff. And
Amazon biohacking.
Amazon biohacking.
The Amazon float tank business is booming.
So when I went to work at Amazon Go, even though I was a longtime insider, I was literally in the 99.44th percentile for tenure when I left. That's how long I've been. Well, that's how much it's grown, and also how short a time most people stay.
When you quit?
Mm-hmm.
You're like, I'm done. Did you cash out? Like, are you done for life?
I'm not done for life. No,
oh, okay.
No. I bought myself some time.
Yeah.
Probably if I had lived really close to the bone for 12 years, I could be done for life. But I don't want to do that.
Yeah.
You know, like that's...
You got to live.
Yeah. Yeah. It's good. It's lucrative. But I couldn't know what the project was, even though I'd been there forever. So I had to try to guess, and I was having these interviews where they were like, it was the most theoretical interviews in the world. It was hilarious. Like, if you had to do something and you didn't know how to do it, how would you do that? I'd be like, well, let me tell you.
Right.
But I was trying to guess like what it could be. And I actually did a little slide in my portfolio presentation. Like, I knew I had some initials and I was guessing. And I remember thinking it could be anything. I was like, it could be telemedicine. It could be health insurance. It could be, it turned out to be just like kind of a cute small grocery store. But I felt like at that point, what could it not be? It had grown so much. And I think that has a lot to do with just the way it's, the success, the way it's growing.
Well, the only complaint that I'm going to issue, I started to say this earlier when we were talking about his net worth and his recent announcement of like this big philanthropic move with the $2 billion.
Yeah.
Is I also heard recently him talking about like space.
Yes, yes.
This
shit
pisses me off to no end.
Yeah.
Like, enough with space.
Yeah. I'm so sick of space.
I'm so sick of space.
Guys with their space thing.
Yeah. It's like, yeah. This is the, for some reason now I'm thinking of the hockey team again.
Right. And Elon Musk.
It's like, stop. We get it.
Yeah.
You know, you're a big thinker. Cause I think that's sort of what it's like. Like, my ambition is so outside.
Right.
I'm in space. I don't know where you are.
On the earth. Yeah.
I'm on Mars. And it's like, dude, you got a lot of money and influence, and there are literally like children there are flies crawling around. You know what I'm saying? Like, let's fix this shit here.
There was a lot of cringing, I mean, among like my friends too. I mean, it's like, you know, the average Amazon employee, you know, we're a very liberal group. There was a lot of like, oh, Jesus. And I think it was the way he phrased it. He was like, the only place I can really think to put my money at this point is into space exploration. I was like, did you mean that? Because that's not the person that I sort of knew. You know, that didn't sound like him. And I was like, oh, come on. And I actually, that day, I sat down and I did back of the envelope calculation of what it would take to test every untested rape kit in America and set up a system.
Wait, test every untested?
So rape kits, you know, when they do like DNA swabs for women report rapes, there's there's 15,000 of them just sitting around labs in the United States untested.
By the way, rape kits are $19.99 on Amazon right now, in case you need one.
And they're primeable.
Prime. They're prime. They can one day shipping.
A 3-pack.
It's a fantastic deal.
And they're just sitting around and like, because there's no money to get them tested because people don't actually really care if rapists are caught. And I just, for some reason, that came to mind. And I was like, okay, what would it take? And there's a nonprofit out there working on this. And I figured out, and I was being wildly over budgeting, for probably $20 million, you could not only test every untested rape kit, which has been proven to work. Like, they actually find rapists when they do this through databases. You could set up a system for tracking and communicating about them going forward. And I was so furious all day that, like, he was talking about space.
Right.
When, like, we have these super basic things that just aren't happening.
And by the way, it's kind of infinite how many things there are to fix on this planet.
Yeah.
So I can understand.
I picked my one, you know.
Yeah, but I'm sympathetic to these people who have massive resources. And they say, well, you know, I can't be all things to all people.
Right.
I have to pick my battles. And I get it. But I think that they can always, most people can do, including me, can always do more than you think you can.
Right, right.
You know, it's like, dude, you're worth $50 billion and you're only given $2 billion. Right. It's like, you know, but far be it from me. I'm not in that position. Who knows what his long-term plans are? He's obviously way smarter with money than I am. So I don't want to get out over my skis. But I think, you know, you drive around Los Angeles, you see people living on the sidewalks everywhere.
Yeah.
And you're just like, this can't be the best that we can do.
Right.
Like
right.
And like teachers, you know, like on the cover of Time magazine, I was just seeing this on Twitter. It's like all these horror stories about how underpaid and basically impoverished teachers are, whether it's like a third grade teacher or like an adjunct professor who's like homeless. And it's like,
oh, yeah.
What the fuck are we doing?
Exactly. And I think with the money thing, it's almost like, at that scale of money, it may be a matter of like, how do you spend it? There probably is a smart way to spend it for long-term growth or something or not. But I don't know. But I am. But yeah, it's hard not to be like, well, you could just solve so many problems. But
here's the puzzle that I turn over in my mind is like, I imagine myself having a huge amount of money. And I think to myself, if like I won the lottery tomorrow and all of a sudden I've got like $300 million in my checking account.
Right. Just sitting there.
Do I immediately disperse it? Because it's like triage. You look around like, where's the most pain?
Right.
Here. You know, right. Like go. Like take care of yourself. Eat. Mm-hmm. You know, here's a roof over your head. Like here's money for medicine, whatever it is. Or do you hire like really smart financial advisors and put like $295 million into their hands and say, over the course of the next century, I'm going to be able to give away like billions of dollars.
Honestly, I think that's what you do. I mean, when Poetry Magazine got that huge bequest a while back,
from,
I remember reading later
the Eli Lilly heir, right?
Yeah. It threw them into chaos for a year. It was a fascinating article because like, they didn't know how to deal with that kind of money. They suddenly had been handed this enormous amount of money and they had to like get their shit together. And I think they could have just been like, we're just going to publish 3 times as many issues or something. And that, but instead it sounds like they were ultimately very smart, figured out how to like keep it going. My dad is a retired dean and he's looking at setting up a foundation in his name for a scholarship. And the idea is that you can only ever spend X percent of it or he's endowing it. I hadn't known how this works. So it keeps going. You don't just, it's not like he's giving them a huge amount of money, but you never run out if you're smart about it. And that's what, you know, what I think Jeff is doing that's smart is I read that that's the preschool part of this. They want to follow a Montessori model in underserved communities. And I thought that was kind of cool because underserved communities so often end up with these rote charter schools that aren't actually teaching kids to think. They're just having them memorize stuff. And I was like, that's neat. If you're taking kids and giving them like this Montessori model where they're actually learning to think for themselves and function, you're really investing in the future.
And like
then.
Do pottery.
Yeah, do pottery, make candles. You know, that's Waldorf. I guess.
Weave. Yeah,
right,
whatever.
Weave, speak German.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's really, it brings up a lot of like complicated feelings.
Oh, yeah.
When you start talking about money and the ills of the world and like how we prioritize and fix things. But
yeah. And I mean, Amazon is a company. I mean, and living in Seattle, it's, you know, there are people who, I worked for Amazon Publishing for a while, and I had friends from, we hired people from New York Publishing who lost all their friends because they took a job. I mean,
with Amazon?
Yeah.
Because it's like you left the,
you joined the evil empire, uh-huh. And they lost, and maybe those relationships came back, but it was a dire enough and like what, and seen as like an evil enough move to make that, you know, people they'd known for their whole lives, like no longer spoke to them. And for me, from the inside, it was always a complicated place. It was never all good or all bad. It's still not.
That's
whether it's a net
that...
good or it's just life is complicated.
Yeah.
And so.
But those picking centers or whatever, those warehouses are fucking hardcore.
Yeah, I've never visited one, but those stories were. It made me aware of how much I lived in a bubble, living and working in corporate.
Sure.
And in the home office.
They should make everybody go pick for a month.
They used to. They used to make people do it because they just needed the bodies at Christmas time.
Go shadow a picker.
Yeah, yeah.
Jeff should have to go shadow a picker.
Yeah. Well, there's actually a program where if you were at the level I was. Or above, you're supposed to take a, it's essentially a class now. They don't actually just want you on the floor picking now because you would just fuck stuff up. Like it's such a system. They're like, get this senior VP out of here.
Yeah.
But it was like a class where you would do bits and pieces of different things and you do gift wrapping and stuff. And somehow I was supposed to take it or be fired because you have to do it. And I never did it. And eventually they just stopped bothering me. But I regret that I didn't do it because I find that kind of thing fascinating. And like, I used to love on Sesame Street or Electric Company when they do the things where it's like, here's how peanut butter gets made and put in jars.
Yeah.
Like, I just find that kind of, I should have probably worked in operations in a factory, but I would have loved to have seen that. Yeah. It's a different world than corporate.
Sure. Well, and it's also sure. Like the complexity. If you think about the volume of business that Amazon's doing, all the different products and the speed with which they're delivering them and the consistency and like, talk about operations.
I know. I mean, like things that have to be at certain temperatures. I think about things like perfume or food or, and I think I've had maybe one order go really awry and maybe I've just been lucky, but like they get it right more often than not. It's kind of bizarre.
I just had to do a customer service call because I got, like I made a return.
Mm-hmm.
I had to like return something to Amazon and then I got an email out of the blue that said like, we never received this.
Oh,
so you're going to be charged.
Mm-hmm.
And I called them up and I was like, well, I sent this back.
Mm-hmm.
And like, it was like, okay. Oh, yep. Done.
Yep.
Like all taken care of.
Yep.
You know,
I had to shadow customer service for a day once every 2 years. And it's like the most fun. So basically you just sit with someone. I mean, they rotate you around. And you know, they pick the best people who can also won't be thrown by having, it's like me sitting there listening to everything they say, but you have a headset on, you can hear the customer. And I asked this,
are you on mute?
You can't
interject.
You can't be, what I think you should do is,
hi, Christy Coulter here.
Just want to thank you for being customer. Thank you. And this one guy, there had been a call that was a little bit stressful. And I noticed he had a little Amazon branded Zen garden on his desk with like a little rake and everything. And I said, do you get stressed out doing this? And he said, well, I worked for Comcast for 8 years in customer service before this. And my best Comcast customer was worse than my worst Amazon customer. And I was like, why? Because it's got to be some of the same people. And he said, because the Amazon people, when they call, they know I'm probably going to be able to fix their problem. You know, yeah. We really empower them. Take as much time as you need. There's no like timing the calls and just fix it. And he was like, so even if they're upset, like I'm generally able to just fix it. And we also give customers, you know, a lot of slack. I mean, I'm sure there's metrics where it's like, okay, if you did that 9 times in a row, we'd be like, look, Brad, you know.
Well, that's the thing. I've spent so much money on Amazon in my life.
Yeah.
And have made like 2 returns.
Right.
It would be a really bad business practice
to be punitive,
to not just be like, I mean, not even punitive, just to not just like do bend over backwards to make it right.
Exactly.
It's not worth it.
Exactly.
You know, well, make me happy and I'll just keep being your, you know, money person or whatever.
Sitting with
customer,
your money person, your money giving guy, the Kindle, the people who worked in Kindle customer service were amazing because like, you know, you literally get these people calling up being like, my Kindle doesn't work and I don't know why. And they're so trained. And they'd have that model Kindle in front of them and they'd literally walk through it with the customer. And
or just give them a new one.
Well, sometimes that's what they did. Like if they couldn't just get
keep
to
buying
it,
bucks.
They'd be like, let me just send you a new one.
Well, weren't they going to give the hardware? I mean, they're basically giving the hardware away for free.
Yeah.
Because once people have that, then it's just like a cash cow.
You can get all kinds of stuff. Yeah. But it was like, I would just be sitting there thinking, oh my God, this woman just spent, you know, 40 minutes on the phone with someone getting their Kindle to work. And it's really hard to talk, especially if it's someone who they really don't get what's wrong. You'd have customers who are like, I think it's this, and they'd be right. But it was kind of amazing. It was like, I always walked away, and this sounds like the kind of condescending thing executives say, but I always walked away being like, I could not do that job.
Yeah.
Like it was astounding.
You got to have a certain patience.
Yeah.
And temperament.
Yeah. And temperament. It was really temperament. I think they hired for that. Like,
it's because of the branded Zen garden on the desk.
Exactly. That must be why.
Just rake that sand.
I knew the VP of customer service at the time, and he's like the nicest guy in the world. And he kind of came up through Amazon, like post-college, I think worked in customer service and rose up. And I was like, that's exactly the kind of thing Tom would, like, who knows? I doubt the VP came up with the Zen garden idea, but I was like, that has his heart around it. And it made me feel good to think taking care of these people.
Like Amazon branded, like stress squeezy bowl.
Right. I used to say there should be Amazon branded, like cortisol tests. Like I wanted to force everybody to get their cortisol measured.
What is that again?
It's stress. A stress hormone.
Right.
Yeah. And there'd be times that I was just like, oh my God, we all need to get our cortisol tested and then like see what we can do about it. And you know,
I am going to wager that Jeff Bezos gets his cortisol tested
every day,
every morning.
It's through like
6:30.
A chip he has implanted or something.
His shadow
right.
does a blood draw at dawn.
Oh my God. It'd be great if his shadow actually like slept in a little cot, like co-sleeping. You know?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. No, I'm picturing
bassinet.
Like some sort of sealed chamber or something, uh-huh. You know, coffin like
the Batcave. Yeah.
Oxygen, like an oxygen, a hyperbaric chamber.
Right.
So you're done there. You wrote and published this book.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You're taking some time. You're writing another. You're writing a novel.
I'm writing a novel, though my second book is probably also going to be a memoir.
About drinking and stuff? Are you done? Like, have you exhausted yourself on this topic, do you feel like?
Maybe, yeah. I mean, it's definitely not like I'm not looking for a career that's like writing about sobriety and drinking. It's going to be more about like female ambition and money and work.
Because that's also what this book is about.
It up, yeah.
For people listening who haven't read, you know, it's your drinking and sobriety story, but it's also very much tied to being a woman in the world.
Yeah, yeah. So the next book is similar. It's about like because drinking was sort of a symptom of the things I was dealing with. But like I've always been very ambitious. I like to do big things. And that doesn't always work with being a woman. Like people don't. They get very weird about that. So it's going to be about like being about female ambition, wanting to be like a force in the world and money and just what it's like to work as a woman in sort of these crazy environments. I realized I've spent my whole career working for like men with big dreams. I worked for a guy who's trying to cure all genetic diseases in dogs when I was very young, and which he's still working on it. He's made some progress. It's great. I worked for the guy who started the All Music Guide. I worked there for 7 years, which was to make a database of every recording ever made. And then I worked for Jeff Bezos. And I was like, that's interesting. Like, I never just went and got a normal job. It was always like these men with huge dreams. And I started thinking, why didn't you ever think of having that huge dream? And part of it is I may be the kind of person who makes things better rather than who takes a good idea and makes it better. And that's valid. But also I think that, you know, you think about like 2% of venture capital money goes to women. And that's not because it's the world of venture capital of startups is only 2% female. So there's something there. So it'll be another memoir. It's not like a business book. It's not a polemic. It'll be like this, like funny and raw, hopefully, that's what I was going for, and real and in my voice. I do have a novel, which I do want to get back to at some point. I was a fiction writer for... my MFA was in fiction, and that's what I always thought I was going to write. And I love it. But I feel like this other book is kind of gnawing at me. So
Well, yeah, you got to follow it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I think the time is ripe for that conversation.
I feel like that too.
Especially I was in tech for a lot of this. I wasn't in technical roles, but I was in the tech industry.
But you succeeded too.
And, yeah.
You know, you were able to flourish in those like male dominated environments, mm-hmm. working for those like strong, you know, whatever, men with big dreams or whatever.
Yeah, made it. It's funny. I got invited recently to speak somewhere and they said about being successful at Amazon. And I realized that I don't think of myself as successful. But I made it there for 12 years. I mean, by any count, I was successful.
12 years is a long time to work in a corporation.
Yeah.
It's really a long time to work in any organization, especially like a big beast like that.
Absolutely. Well, part of it is that I could change roles, you know, so you can kind of reinvent yourself. I mean, I did a bunch of different things, but yeah, I realized also that I kind of installed a little man in my brain. I realized this after I left. I said to my husband one day, like, I think I might think like a man now, because men were so responsible for my success or failure that without knowing it, I kind of put some little dude in my brain. I would filter everything I thought or said through him before I would say it.
There's a little hockey player living
inside
you.
He's a little hockey player. He's a little, I picture him wearing a little tuxedo. He's kind of like, he looks like, actually, I just realized he looks like Poirot. That's a little strange for someone who's in tech.
Yeah. I've worked for almost 2 hours in this conversation to get that admission.
Exactly. It's for me to realize it.
There's a little Poirot.
There's a little Poirot in my mind who's like, let me say something. but I really do think I sort of put this filter on. And we all adapt to our audience. But my audience was so heavily male and very alpha male that I was like, fuck, I'm a dude now. Like, Amazon turned me into a dude. And I have to figure out, who am I? And it's not like I think male and female brains are that different or something. But it really... I have to figure out how to like think and live.
You need
in the
to
world.
Hang out with some beta males like me.
Exactly. Well, I've been doing that since I quit. So, you know, now I'm hanging out with writers. And, you
right.
Know, like, podcasters. I don't have a job.
And, you know, in a garage.
It's been kind of awesome. But yeah, so I was like, okay, there's really something to explore there. Like, what does it do? Like, I was successful, but what did it do to me? I mean, partly it didn't, Amazon didn't turn me into an alcoholic, but certainly it coincided with the onset of my alcoholic drinking.
It didn't help.
Yeah.
Work
and I was
stress.
There for 4 years sober too. And I made that work. But yeah, the stress and the catastrophic thinking, you know, I would love to take a look at like what do those big dream environments like do to people and what's the cost of it? Even though it's also kind of amazing. Like I wouldn't give that experience back for anything.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I know very few people who don't like have like mixed feelings or complain about Amazon. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I also know very few people who don't use the fuck out of it.
Exactly. Yeah. When Manchester by the Sea came out, I was the Kenneth Lonergan film. I was seeing it in the theater.
By the way, hilarious movie.
It's kind of. For what it is. It's funny.
Yeah. Kenneth Lonergan's wonderful. I'm just saying like, man.
Yeah.
Heavy.
Oh man, it was brutal. I love Margaret, his second film that took like a decade to get released. That's amazing movie.
Is
it's
that the
a
one
mess.
With Nicole Kidman?
No.
Who's in it?
Anna Paquin, Mark Ruffalo. There's a ton. Matt Damon. Nicole Kidman may be in there somewhere. I think he had Blue Room or Blue Chair or something.
I don't know.
Anyway, it's great. It's a mess, but it's great.
Or no, I think I'm thinking of a Noah Baumbach movie, I think.
Oh, Margot at the Wedding.
Margot at the Wedding.
Yeah.
That's what I'm thinking of.
God, that's fine. Yeah, I haven't seen that in a long time.
Yeah.
But the title card, Amazon Studios, came up. This is in Seattle, and people booed. And I was like, come on. You're about to see this movie. This is a great film, really difficult film. Like, it's not an easy thing to bankroll, you know? And like, you're really going to sit there and boo? Like, it just, and it felt very performative, like very like Seattle.
Virtue signaling.
Yeah.
That's
Seattle
what
gets super teenage about
it.
I was like, why don't you
Amazon.
Get up and walk out and ask for your money back? You all seem to be sitting on your asses watching this movie, you know?
And Casey Affleck starred in it.
Yeah. Oh God. Then it was like, well, it's immoral to see it. I was like, you know what? I get it.
It's tough.
I'm still going to go see the movie.
I think Casey Affleck has a drinking problem.
Oh yeah, I mean, something's going on there.
Like, to go with it. I mean, you know, not to excuse behavior.
Yeah.
But it sounds to me, with my limited understanding of the circumstances, that he was hammered and like crawled into bed with somebody.
Oh yeah.
And it's like, not good.
Not good. Not good.
But like, is he like the devil now?
Right, right. There's a difference between that and like actual predatory behavior.
And by the way,
behavior.
My understanding of his behavior, maybe he is. I don't want to
over.
I don't want to
over. From Us Magazine or something, right?
I gleaned this from the pages of Us Magazine in like a dental office.
That's kind
of
what I got too. And it was like, he was hanging out with Joaquin Phoenix. Probably not a great idea.
Yeah.
You know, but the performance was astounding.
Yeah.
It was so. It was one of the most real.
My wife and I went, like, we never get to go to the movies, like, for adult movies because we have kids. And it was, like, right around Thanksgiving, I think.
Oh, yeah, yeah. This
and
when all the
my parents could watch the kids, and I was like, let's go see a good movie.
Let's go see Manchester.
The one chance we have to go see a movie, and it's about, like, a guy who gets, like, loaded and burns his house down, kills his kids. And we're just like, oh, my
God. You're like, wait a second. Like, there's something to be said for not knowing too much before you walk into a movie, but sometimes you do want to know.
I had no idea what I was walking into.
Right, right.
And, like, walked out, and we were just like, do you want to go to Houston's and get dinner? And like, it was, like, our date night. Right. And I was like, we sat at the bar, like, not looking at each other.
Just, like, right, right.
Eating fries.
Like, is this what all adult movies are like now?
Yeah, right.
Is this how it is?
I need, it's weird how much I've fallen out with movies. I used to always go to the movies.
Yeah, I see a ton. I see, I go to the Seattle Film Festival every year. It goes on for a month. I buy a pass and I'll just walk
in. I gotta do that. I gotta get back
into
it. It's because it's nice too. It's like dream time.
Yeah, yeah.
I used to love it.
Yeah, it's great. And you'll see a lot of like, for a festival, you know, it's like a lot of things at festivals aren't that good. But
yeah.
but it's kind of things you wouldn't have seen otherwise. And then now and then you'll see like a major gem and just a sense of discovery. And I love it. I love movies. I'll see like virtually anything. Actually, I'm pickier than I used to be. But when
what's
I was
good, what's good this year?
I loved Blindspotting. It's a movie about like the gentrification of Oakland. This sounds like a drag. It sounds like homework. It's really funny. It's about these two longtime friends, a black guy and a white guy. And it's the black guy's last day on parole. And so it's sort of a buddy comedy, but it's really cutting and kind of poetic.
So it's a fiction.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's fiction. Yeah. I mostly see fiction films.
Yeah.
Loved that. I just saw something. You know what's really scary is Hereditary. I don't see many horror films.
Oh, yeah. People have been like, for some reason, I noticed there were people like going like multiple times to see this.
I have not yet. I would like to see it a second time, but every time, and it's on streaming now, but every time I think about it, I'm like, ugh, it's genuinely scary.
Who's
like,
in that?
Toni Collette, Gabriel Byrne.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Couple other people. It's terrifying. It's like it'll make you feel bad.
I feel like there's something happening in the culture with respect to horror.
Mm-hmm.
Like horror has always been there, but I feel like now it's got more currency than it usually does. Or
yeah.
People are responding to it more, or these movies are becoming infused with more and deeper meaning or something. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, like Get Out. I remember Jordan Peele saying he thought of it because it's not. I mean, it's horror. It's horror light. He thinks of it as like a social thriller, you know. That was
that's
like,
a good way to put it.
Yeah. And the cool thing about that was the things that happen to the and Hereditary is the same way. The things that happen to the characters are bad, whether they're supernatural or not. So, like, there's enough horror in Get Out just from this guy dealing with being like the one black guy in the group,
right?
You know, it's like, oh, these things really happen to people. And in Hereditary, it's like all these family dynamics and death in the family that are just utterly horrifying without any kind of ghost action. So I do think people, it's like it's gotten elevated as a genre.
It's also because they're cheap to make.
Yeah.
And if you get a hit, you make a fucking truckload of money.
Oh, yeah, because
you can go explore space.
Right, exactly.
You can go to Mars with that horror movie money.
Yeah. I think the best ones are cheap to make because they're not really, like once you see the monster, you know, I don't care if I ever see the monster.
Yeah.
What was the one, A Quiet Place that came out this year? It was actually really good about this world where, and they never really explain it, but it's been taken over by these monsters that just travel by sound and they hunt by sound. They're blind. And so it basically plunks you down in a world like in America somewhere where just you can't make any noise. And it's about this family. It's Emily Blunt and John Krasinski, and she's pregnant. And it's just a few days in their life. And it's just so good. It's such a good premise, and it's so tightly executed.
Sort of like Nightmare on Elm Street. You can't fall asleep.
Yeah. And it's like you can't, and she's pregnant, and you're like, she's going to give birth. But once you see the
you
monster,
you have to give birth silently.
Like, yeah. Yeah. You're like, it's not, you know, it's a monster. It's spooky, but okay,
baby's
now
born,
I've seen it.
Got to muffle the baby.
Oh, and the way that they handle that is so, it's just so good. Yeah.
Oh,
but it was cheap to make because
I was joking. That's for real. They got to muffle the kid.
Yeah, of course you do.
Sure.
Right? Yeah. So, I mean, the only thing I was like, really, would you have gotten pregnant? Like the world was just taken over by like sonic monsters and most of the people on Earth are dead. Like, I don't know that I'd really be in the mood for sex for a little while.
Yeah.
And not only that, but to actually get knocked up. But I'm not that character.
Can't stop nature.
I'm not in her subjectivity.
Well, it's super fun to meet you.
Yeah, you too.
I appreciate you coming over. Congratulations on your book.
Thank you.
You're in town for a couple more days. Are you taking meetings or are you just hanging?
I am taking meetings.
As
it's
one
really
does.
Really weird. There's some interest in the book for like, you know, like film and TV and
sure.
So I'm doing that. And I'm also doing a little hanging. My best friend lives here and I'm going to see her and I'm actually going to go have lunch with a friend now and about a quarter mile away.
Cool.
And, yeah.
Well, good luck to you.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Okay, that's Christy Coulter. Her essay collection is called Nothing Good Can Come From This. It's available from MCD/FSG Originals. Nothing Good Can Come From This. Go get your copy now. You can find Christy online at ChristyCoulter.com and on Twitter at Christy C. Coulter. Nothing Good Can Come From This. I forgot to ask her if anybody, like within the company, within Amazon, if there is a nickname for Bezos. Like, do people call him like Beezer? The Bees? Does nobody dare? I don't mean that in jest. I sincerely mean that. It's like a name that like sort of begs for a nickname, but I'm not sure if there, you know, if one of those exists. Was he known as like Beezy in college? The Bees? Thanks to Kill Rockstars and the band Stereo Total, as always, for the theme song music. Thank you to Tiger and My Tank for the interstitial music. If you want to support the show, patreon.com/otherpplpod. If you want to... patreon.com/otherpplpod. If you want the app, go get the app. It's available wherever you get your apps. If you want to write to me, it's letters@otherppl.com. Okay, bye.